Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Before I started making this film, I knew nothing about Bobby Kennedy. A privileged guy with 10 kids who became a hero to black and Hispanic communities and promised to heal a divided America. Then a year before I was born, he was assassinated.
50 years ago today, Robert Kennedy was shot in a Los Angeles hotel after winning the Democratic presidential primary in California.
I think that we can end the divisions within the United States.
By the time he died, Kennedy had moved from being an anti-communist supporter of the Vietnam War to an anti-war champion of the rights of the country's black and brown people. Karen Grigsby Bates of our Code Switch team has the story of Kennedy's evolution on race.
In the last year of John Kennedy's term as president, his brother and Attorney General Robert Kennedy hosted a meeting in New York with several black celebrities who were active in the civil rights movement. His friend Harry Belafonte was there. So were writer James Baldwin, playwright Lorraine Hansberry, and singer Lena Horne. But, says writer Larry Tai, Bobby Kennedy and the glamorous creatives were at cross purposes.
They came there, they thought, to tell Bobby what the situation was in American civil rights and what he ought to be doing. Bobby saw the meeting instead as his explaining all the things he and his brother had been trying to do, and he thought that he should get a pat on the back, and people thought he should get a kick in the butt.
Tai, author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, says the group told Kennedy he was moving way too slowly. Stung, Kennedy wrapped up the meeting and fumed for the next couple of days. Then, says Larry Tai, Robert Kennedy did what he always did. He started out with a narrow view.
And he ended up, not long after, being able to put himself in the shoes of the people that he was supposedly facing off against and deciding that they were right and, more importantly, that he was going to try to do something about that.
For a rich kid from Boston who'd had virtually no exposure to the black struggle, that was pretty surprising. In his book, The Promise and the Dream, David Margolick describes the cautious relationship between Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. Margolick says King was a controversial figure for much of white America, but he also had the power of turning out the black vote, a critical demographic.
The Kennedys were politicians, and they had to be careful with Martin Luther King. They had to cultivate him, but they also had to keep their distance from him.
Robert Kennedy wanted to know more about black America beyond just King, so while he was attorney general and later as a senator from New York, Kennedy made several fact-finding excursions to better understand race and poverty. Sometimes he took one of his older children with him. Robert Kennedy Jr. remembers one visit to Harlem.
At one point, a Puerto Rican mother in an apartment that we visited kept cats in the apartment to keep rats from getting into the crib. That would bite her baby.
His son Robert says Kennedy also visited the Mississippi Delta and Appalachia because he wanted Americans to know hunger was not just a problem for people in developing nations.
There were people mainly, in the Senate and the Congress who said starvation does not exist in America.
Robert Kennedy offered eyewitness accounts that showed the fallacy of that assumption. During the late 60s, California farm workers, most of them Mexican-American, were struggling to bring attention to their abysmal working conditions. Lifelong labor activist Dolores Huerta says Robert Kennedy made several visits to the striking farm workers she and Cesar Chavez were organizing in Delano, California.
When the senator came to Delano, it definitely put us on the national scene.
And says Huerta, that support created an affection for Kennedy that has lasted for generations.
When you go to any Latino's family home, you'll often see a tapestry on the wall. And there's Dr. King and John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy.
This week, there will be several events to celebrate Robert Kennedy's life and work. Many of those will be in Black and brown communities throughout the country. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
That's a nappy-headed horse.
After Hurricane Maria hit, many small business owners had hard decisions to make. Could they afford to rebuild? Was it even worth it? Now we're going to introduce you to a hard-charging entrepreneur named Laura Ohm, whose decision to keep the doors open helped women reclaim a sense of normalcy and even pride in the midst of a disaster. My colleague Tom Gelton met Laura Ohm just a few weeks after Hurricane Maria hit. It had rained hard just the day before, and one of her businesses, a restaurant, which had just been cleaned up from the hurricane, flooded again with agua negra, dirty runoff and backed up sewage. She was unsure if the restaurant would survive, but she was determined not to lose her hair salon.
Yes, yes, yes. Hair salon will happen, even if it has to be in the backyard. I can't leave the island. I love this place, and my clientele is here. I know it's going to take a while. Well, the ones that stay here, it's going to take a while for them to have the money and the attitude to get their hair done. But I do a very specific work, and I wanted to influence the Puerto Rican hairstylist.
That's because Ohm specializes in styling curly, natural hair, something that Puerto Rican women often go to great lengths and expense to straighten with chemicals and blow dryers. 8 months after the hurricane, it appears that Hurricane Maria and the subsequent power and water outages created a new market for Laura Ohm's skills. Early on Saturday morning, business at Laura Ohm's salon on Calle Luisa is booming. And Hurricane Maria, in a roundabout way, has something to do with that.
Now, because of not having power, a lot of people had to wear their hair natural because they couldn't blow dry their hair. So they had a lot of people decided to, I'm not going to deal with this anymore, and I don't know what is going to happen next in Puerto Rico, so I'm going to embrace my curly hair and see what I have. Because a lot of people didn't know, a lot of my clients didn't know what kind of hair they had.
They didn't even really know what their natural hair looked like.
Some people get straight hair, like relaxed, since they're 3 or 5 years old.
Do you feel like there might be a movement for natural hair now because people are realizing that, you know,
I think
it's kind of cute.
Yes.
I mean.
No, I'm very happy that I can help even mostly like young girls to love themselves the way they are. And it's not always easy. It's harder. A lot of the times it's harder to wear your hair natural if you have a very curly hair. But we help them to get there. And we are mixed, so we are, you know, we have to embrace that, be happy with that.
Isis Berial is happy with her curly hair. She's here for a haircut. She's gotten naturally curly since the hurricane, which was a big departure from her usual look.
Sí, plancha todo el tiempo.
She says she used to flat iron her hair always.
30 años, yo tengo 48.
Berial is 48 years old, and she says she straightened her hair for 3 decades. Laura Ohm says that's a cultural norm that's been reinforced on the island for a long time.
You know, Latinas and Caribbean, we are educated that if you don't have straight hair, you're not well put together.
That view is starting to change.
My wife is getting her hair done.
Sitting on a chair next to a wall of hair products, Oscar Siri watches sports on the phone while he waits. Oscar says that before Hurricane Maria, his wife did not embrace her natural hair.
No, she had it straight. She's a businesswoman, so that's kind of the style they use. But when we met 24 years ago, she used to have curly hair, so I'm glad she got her groove back.
Every day. every night, all the time.
We are packing up the weed care packages, I guess. Today we've got cookies and gummies and medicated sandwiches as well, and even some medicated capsules and joints as well.
Well, those are care packages being prepared, but you probably heard some clues that they're not the kind of care packages most grandmothers might prepare for you. These are being put together by volunteers with the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users.
Well, thank you. My name is Neil Magnuson, and this is the Cannabis Substitution Project, and we are here in Van Du's main office at 380 East Hastings. Okay, thank you. And we've been operating for 15 months now, a little over that. And what we do is we give away cannabis edibles, concentrates, and joints to people to help them stop using the other street drugs that are killing people. Cannabis is a very effective substitute for many people when used properly, mostly in the edible form. And because edibles are much stronger because it metabolizes through the liver, it's a much longer lasting high. I've been told many times by people over the years that there are hard drug users or injection drug users that a couple of good strong edibles can get them right through the night without injecting any other drugs and not worrying about injecting other drugs. And I know dozens and dozens of people throughout this city that have crossed my path, that many of them working in dispensaries now, that tell me that cannabis saved their life, that they were on that path of injection drug use, and that they got off it with cannabis. And so when this crisis hit, because of my experience in this neighborhood over the past 14 years with cannabis and edibles and how it helps people get off of hard drugs, I knew right away that this was the thing to do to address this crisis.
Hi, I'm Greg. We're they call us the Holy Rollers. We do the rolling of the joints for the giveaway of the packages. I just believe in it. I've helped detox somebody from fentanyl, and I've seen it work. As long as they've got a good enough supply of edibles, but it has to be edibles, they can stay off opiates.
So the idea of doling out weed to people with substance abuse issues might seem counterintuitive, but the idea is gaining traction, partly thanks to the anecdotal evidence like we just heard. But the idea is also backed up by other evidence, including a study published in May in the prestigious Journal of the American Medical Association, a study that suggested a link between cannabis legalization and lower rates of opioid prescription. And the University of British Columbia will be investigating the potential for cannabis to mitigate the harms of the opioid crisis, thanks to a research endowment from one of Canada's biggest marijuana growers. Canopy Growth ponied up $2.5 million in the province of BC, added another $500,000 to create the Canopy Growth Professorship in Cannabis Science. The research will be done in conjunction with the BC Centre on Substance Use, and Dr. Evan Wood is the director of the center, and he joins us from Vancouver. Hello.
Hello.
Well, first off, where do you see potential for cannabis to help in dealing with the opioid crisis?
Well, you know, first off, I should note that for the opioid crisis, we need many things, and this will just be a piece of the puzzle. You know, we need more recovery supports, we need more medical supports, more harm reduction. But something that's emerged in the scientific literature in recent years that's really attracted a lot of attention is that in states in the U.S. where there are medical marijuana laws, there are lower rates of opioid overdose. And when you look at prescription opioid prescribing in states in the U.S. that have medical marijuana laws, have lower rates of prescription opioid prescribing. That alongside more basic science research showing that people are able to have reduced craving and reduce their opioid use when they're using cannabinoids has opened up a range of hypotheses where people are really looking to see, is there something that can be done to reduce the harms of opioid use if people are offered cannabinoids or other cannabis or other cannabinoid preparations as a strategy to reduce craving and ultimately people's use of opioids. So this is something that we've observed in Vancouver, where at some of the overdose prevention sites, cannabis is being given out to people, and qualitatively they're reporting less opioid use. And from the University of British Columbia perspective, this is something we'd really like to rigorously evaluate.
Dr. Evan Wood is the director of the BC Center on Substance Abuse. He's in Vancouver. As he said, the research around cannabis and its potential role in curbing the opioid crisis is still in its infancy, and most of the evidence is still anecdotal. We spoke with clients and volunteers at the overdose prevention site, known as TOPS, in Vancouver's downtown east side, where there's a fledgling cannabis program. Joy says she struggled with an addiction to opioids for 2 years.
I started using opiates too for pain because I have a bad sciatic nerve pain. If you know anything about sciatica, it is like the worst pain in the world. And honestly, the best way I got off it for myself is, believe it or not, using marijuana. I eat edibles. I like edibles. It's got THC is put into whatever food. Usually it's through gummies, candies, cookies, that kind of thing. And that's definitely been a big helper getting off the opiates. I would never go back using opiates, being I've started the weed program here that we have here at TOPS. See, THC, especially when you eat in edibles, it's really effective. It's like I found it relaxes me. When I'm in major pain, it relaxes me. It also helps with my sleep. And the very best thing I could suggest to anyone, if they're using opiates and want to get off, is try using weed. Weed is more natural. There's no chemicals. There shouldn't be any chemicals in it, depending on where you get it from. You should always make sure whoever you get your weed from, that it's from like a good source. Also, if you eat, I would suggest with your edibles, you eat well, you get sleep. And honestly, if I can do it, if I can get off opiates using weed, I think anybody can.
Derek Nash and Joy are volunteers at the overdose prevention site in Vancouver, and both of them use cannabis to reduce their opioid dependency. Not everyone, however, is convinced that cannabis offers a pathway out of the opioid crisis. Dr. Sharon Levy is the director of the Adolescent Substance Use and Addiction Program at Boston Children's Hospital and an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. She says there are lessons from the past that should make us very wary of embracing marijuana. And we have reached her in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello.
Good morning.
What worries you about the idea of policymakers embracing cannabis as a way out of the opioid crisis?
So actually, I'd like to start by saying that I'm an addiction medicine specialist, just like, and I agree with Dr. Wood on many of his points, including that there will not be one single solution to the opioid crisis. It's a difficult problem, and we're going to need lots of different strategies to get ourselves out of it. I have concerns about the idea of liberalizing access to marijuana as a strategy for addressing the opioid crisis. And so not only am I an addiction medicine specialist, and I understand how difficult opioid addiction is and how important it is that we search for solutions, I'm also a pediatrician. And when you think about public health strategies, you have to think about the entire population. So while it's so important to give people access to things that might help them prevent opioid overdose, you also have to remember that the large majority of the population is actually not addicted to opioids. And when we open up access and potentially drive more marijuana use, could actually be causing a lot more problems than we're fixing with a policy like that.
Okay, you have pointed out to some historical examples of drug promotion and adoption gone wrong, including some recent history that suggests we should be concerned by this idea. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so actually there are a number of examples in which substances were promoted for their health benefits before we had real equipoise. In other words, before we really understood the benefits and harms of an individual substances. There are lots of examples over the past couple hundred years. I think one really striking example is electronic cigarettes. These came out really just a little bit more than a decade ago. At the time they came out, they were really promoted as having very meaningful harm reduction potential for adult smokers. So the idea was that we would take people who were addicted to nicotine, who could not quit smoking, and we would offer them a less harmful product that would allow them to switch and give up their cigarettes. So this was even promoted in the U.S. by somebody who had served as a former Surgeon General. And I would say that electronic cigarettes actually came out with a lot of fanfare. The message got interpreted as this product is safe, they're harmless, and they may be good for you. And really what we've seen in the ensuing years is that the children and teens who these products, granted, they were not intended for them, but that's actually a group that's really gotten a hold of them. And we've actually seen nicotine use and nicotine addiction reintroduced into communities where we really had not been seeing it for a long period of time. So traditional cigarette use had really dropped amongst a large majority of middle class kids in the U.S. And now this very same group is starting to use these nicotine products in high numbers, and they, the research is starting to show us that they develop addiction quickly. Kids tend to develop addiction more quickly than adults, and they typically become dual users. So we're actually also reintroducing, ironically, traditional tobacco products.
Okay, I want to bring up another example, and this is about Purdue, the drug manufacturer, and the criticism that they promoted opioids, which has helped lead to the opioid crisis and the abuse of the drugs that they made. So when we look at this situation in British Columbia, where we have a major a marijuana grower funding research, do you have concerns about those things?
Yeah, so I do have some concerns. I think Dr. Wood made a lot of good points, and I think that, unrestricted philanthropy addresses certain the most pernicious problems in a certain way. But there are other problems that I think are much harder to address, and that is, just as you're saying about Purdue, there's a certain, even without any intentionality, there's a certain marketing strategy in promoting a substance as health promoting. And as you mentioned, this is exactly what we saw with the opioids when they came on the market in the 1990s. They were really promoted as health promoting, something that could treat pain and improve function. And that message, it's very difficult to control these messages. And that message got out in a way that these products are safe and benign. We all know what happened. People started using them in large, big quantities, and the opioid addiction crisis really ensued. So, I think that we have to, controlling the message is something that's particularly difficult to do. And when substances get promoted as something that are taking care of a health problem, we've seen before where that is that starts a trend of them being overused.
Let's talk specifically about the connection between marijuana use and lowering opioid addiction, which is where this argument, sort of this discussion started from. But there seems to be some credible evidence, including that study published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, back in May, that liberalization of access to cannabis, and I should mention our marijuana laws are set to change here in Canada, seem to have some correlation with lower rates of prescription for opioids. So I get that it's trading one drug for another, but there is the argument that one is, well, much better than the other.
I think people will try and make that argument, but I'd be highly skeptical of it. It is true that by and large, because cannabis does not stop people from breathing. You don't have the tremendous problem with overdose, with lethal overdose. And so, that is certainly a benefit. But when you look at the long-term harms of cannabis exposure, I think that we know enough about it to know that there are real harms that are actually quite serious. The best understood harms are those to younger people, to adolescents who use cannabis. There is actually a developing body of research, but really enough to understand that cannabis use during the adolescent years is associated with increased risks of mental health problems, of lower functioning as adults. There have been some studies that have linked cannabis use to declines in cognitive functioning or drops in IQ over the lifetime. So these are very serious problems. And I don't know how people could say one problem is worse than another, but I think that that's actually rather subjective.
Dr. Sharon Levy, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
I hear a lot of people saying opioid crisis and crack epidemic. Crack is a street name, but for opioids, we don't use street name. We say opioids. We don't say dog food. And we say crisis for opioids, but with the crack, we say epidemic. So I think that the way things are talked about is huge in white supremacy. And when black people are alleged to be the perpetrators of something, it's talked about very differently and talked about as, you know, vile and all of that, and criminal. But when white people are doing it, it's talked about differently. So it's a crisis that they're dying, and it's an epidemic that we are. So I just think that it should be talked about in the same way, and there should be consistency that if you're going to say opioid crisis, you should say cocaine crisis, and if you're going to say crack epidemic, you should say dog food epidemic.
Elementary school teachers get a glimpse into the family lives of many children. You may see the side effects on a kid whose parents are unemployed or getting divorced. Now imagine a school where one small kid after another comes from families facing drug addiction. Rachel Martin has the view from inside a school in southeastern Ohio in a devastated community she's focused on this week. And a word of caution, some details in this story are disturbing.
When a parent is fighting addiction, sometimes the only place their kids feel safe is school. And teachers and staff are the first to see signs that something's not right.
They'll just walk into the office and start crying, and they hug you, and you sit down and talk with them and find out what's going on in their secret little world.
This is Mary Ann Hale. She is the principal at West Elementary School in Vinton County. She tells me that the school is aware of about 60 kids who've been directly affected by the drug crisis here. Sometimes the children are so overwhelmed they just come out and say what's going on. Most of the time, though, she has to read the signs.
A slide in their academic behaviors, and then also aggression, crying, or kids talking about suicide.
In elementary school?
Yes. We've been dealing with one of those this year. Mom's an addict. Dad kind of went sideways when mom left, and grandma's raising the little girl.
This happens a lot in Vinton County. Parents are too consumed with addiction to care for their kids, and other family members step in, usually grandparents.
Hi, I'm Rachel. Okay.
The school principal introduces us to a woman who's asked us to call her Angela instead of her real name in order to protect her family's privacy. We find an empty classroom and sit down at a table. Kids run around in the hallway outside. Angela looks tired. She tells us she'll be 60 this year, but she looks a lot older than that. Her daughter has been on and off drugs for years, and recently it got so bad with meth that Angela and her husband are now taking care of their grandson. We're calling him Billy. She remembers what it was like right after he was born.
One day she brought him to the house. When he was in diapers, he was about a year old, and he had to smell to him, and he was beet red, like he's been out in the sun. She had him in a meth house, and the chemicals is what burned his skin, made him red.
That part of Billy's story is harrowing enough, but it takes an even darker turn as we keep talking. Angela says her daughter was living with a boyfriend at one point, not Billy's father, some other guy. One day, Billy went to his grandmother complaining about pain. And we should note, what you're about to hear involves an allegation of child sexual abuse.
He told me, he says, "Grandma, my bottom hurts." I says, "Well, you got diarrhea again?" Because every so often he'd get it. "No," he says, "I don't." And so I checked him out, and I see his rectum was bigger than what it should be. And he had a tear, the bottom part. Her fellow that she's living with did things he shouldn't have to him. And then I I went and filed a report. And it did a heck of a number on him. He don't like talking to strangers. When I got him, he would not go close to a guy. Mm. And even his grandpa, he shied away from.
Angela and her husband got custody of Billy at the end of April.
When he started staying at the house, he would wet the bed. And he like I said, he'd have nightmares. And still, he won't sleep in a room by himself.
Does he sleep with you guys in your bedroom?
He sleeps on the couch. And I'm there because I never know when he's going to have his nightmares.
He's awfully lucky to have you, though.
I hope so. He means the world to me. I don't know. I just keep hoping she's going to change. But as she said on the phone, "You guys took my boy away from me, and now I ain't got nothing," she says. And she's back on the mess again.
I'm sorry.
Angela asks if I want to meet Billy. She goes to get him from his class. He comes in and slouches down into his grandma's lap. His hands are fighting in the pockets of his camouflaged pattern sweatshirt.
"You can talk to him, honey."
Billy's head is down. He doesn't really want to talk.
"What's the matter? You seem down under the dumps. Huh?
I'm waiting to get back to class."
"You can
call hi. It was nice to meet you.
I'll see you at home." He's been that way since he seen his mom the other day.
Blue.
Yep, he stays that way for about a week or two. Yeah, it takes a little bit for him to come back out of it again.
Mm-hmm. Now we're getting, you know, the ramifications of kids that don't have parents, kids that live in alternate environments, whatever that may be.
This is Rebecca Smallwood. She's a counselor here at West Elementary. She has seen a lot of kids like Billy come through this school.
With dad because mom's gone, mom because dad's gone, grandparents, aunt, foster care. And that kind of disruption and what it does to a student forever. Mm-hmm. It's huge. You can't use enough adjectives to describe what that does.
With that, the school day is over. We hear kids running through the halls of West Elementary. The school secretary on the PA system starts to make announcements.
"Please go home with Dorset. Please go to Grandma's today."
For many of the kids in Vinton County, school is their only safe space. It's where there is structure and regular meals and people who keep track of their lives. Very literally, they know who drops them off and picks them up every single day. But school is almost over. It's summertime. So I ask the principal, Marianne Hale, what she does now. Her answer? We worry.
Rachel Martin in Vinton County, Ohio.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', a chip off the block.
That's a nappy-headed hose.
It's a social media post by a teacher at a Brampton Elementary School that the board is calling anti-black racism. In the photo, you see the back of a young student's head and their braids. Next to it is an image of a character played by actor Marlon Wayans with a similar hairstyle, holding a gun in a 90s comedy flick. Below is the caption, "Who rocked it better? Laugh out loud." I'm Adrian Gobriel. We're outside of the Peel District School Board, where senior staff are investigating the claims tonight. Now, we've decided not to broadcast the name of the Brampton Elementary School in an effort to protect the student. The board says they became aware of the social media post after some concerned parents discovered it on the teacher's Instagram story.
And I think you'd be hard-pressed to look at that particular image and to say that it's not a post that would be considered racism. I think if you look at it, you look at the use of black stereotypes and you look at how the child is being compared to another individual in not a very nice way, I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that it isn't anti-black racism, even though that's what we're hearing from some of the members of the community who say, you know, it's just a joke, it's not really racist.
I'm so
We got a problem, stupid?
The image beside the young student is of Lock Dog, a character played by Marlon Wayans in the 1996 movie Don't Be a Menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood. The board says they became aware of the social media post on Saturday.
We do consider it an anti-black racism post, and certainly that's concerning for us. It's distressing to a certain degree, and we began as a result of that an investigation almost immediately.
The educator under investigation is an occasional teacher, according to the board. City News has learned that she would often supply as a kindergarten teacher at the Brampton Elementary School, where the photo of the student was taken. The teacher has been assigned to home. That means she can't pick up shifts with the board or communicate with students or staff.
I don't think so. It is the right way to do it from a teacher. Yeah.
You know,
that's what I can say, because I'm a settlement counselor, so I work with my clients, and I don't see this appropriate.
That's sad. That's not nice. It's kind of bullying.
What do we teach our children?
Not to bully, and don't say bad things if you have nothing nice to say. That's sad. I feel sorry for that kid.
We do have professional and ethical standards for our teachers and policies and procedures that should protect against these types of things. In this case, that's failed a bit.
In part, the Peel District School Board social media guidelines for staff reads, the Supreme Court of Canada has ruled that teachers' off-duty conduct, even when not directly related to students, is relevant to their suitability to teach. As such, staff should use sound judgment and due care when using social media while on and off duty.
This isn't necessarily about social media. It's about doing the right thing by the students that we serve and the families that we serve. And in this particular case, whether it was done face-to-face or on social media, it's just not appropriate.
That said, social media training is offered to staff here in Peel, though it's not mandatory. The board says they have reached out to the students' guardians. Now, when it comes to discipline, the board also says the teacher could be facing anything from a verbal reprimand, perhaps some sensitivity training, and possible termination.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me, and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Clinical trials offer patients access to experimental therapies that could help people with cancer and other diseases. Trial diversity ensures the most accurate results, but more people of color need to participate. St. Louis Public Radio's Sarah Fentum reports on Siteman Cancer Center's efforts to improve diversity by bringing the science to people's neighborhoods.
Earlier this year, Judy Hall's doctor told her she had cancer. She called it a nightmare.
It was very scary at the beginning when I found out.
The diagnosis wasn't a new one for her family. Her daughter had had breast cancer too. She recommended Hall go to Siteman's newest cancer center in North St. Louis, three blocks away from where her family lived. That's where Hall decided to participate in a trial for an experimental drug to shrink her tumor.
So I said, well, yeah, that'd be a good idea to help other women that's going through it. Maybe it's something small that I'll be able to help them understand it better.
Hall took special medicine and visited her doctor every week. The whole trial, she stayed at her daughter's house down the street.
Being around family, if you can, it's a good thing.
Siteman Deputy Director John DiPersio says the clinic Hall visited was one of several the institution built to care for underserved populations and also to increase their participation in clinical trials.
The goal of this cancer center is to make everything available for everybody that would be available for the richest Caucasian person that lives in Ladue.
For years, most clinical trial patients were white men. While the gap is closing, fewer than 10% of cancer clinical trial participants are people of color. That's despite the fact the disease disproportionately affects African Americans, who have the highest death rate and shortest survival for most cancers. Ideally, DiPersio says, every person could easily come to Siteman's main campus across from Forest Park, which boasts the most specialized doctors and facilities. But that can be hard, especially for people on the predominantly black North Side.
And so what we've done is we've done the next best thing and we've spread out to satellites.
Now there are trials at all four Siteman satellites. Radiation oncologist Lannis Hall, no relation to Judy, works at the St. Charles location. She's also the clinical outreach coordinator for the program to eliminate cancer disparities at Washington University.
If we're going to reduce disparities, the only way that we're going to find the solutions is through clinical studies.
Hall says the lack of diversity is bad for public health.
If you don't participate in clinical studies, it may be that an outcome will be applied generally to the population that may not be right for you.
For example, most organizations advocate mammograms after women turn 45 or 50, but those recommendations were based on studies with limited diversity. In fact, 30% of black women discover breast cancer before their 50th birthday. Those screening guidelines can put them at risk. Hall says lots of patients tell her they don't have time or energy to participate. By bringing science to people, one of the many barriers to participation is removed. In a still segregated city such as St. Louis, that matters.
A significant portion of our community of color resides in North St. Louis and in North County, and therefore Siteman in North County really may be easier for people to get to. In fact, we know that is the case.
Trials help patients, too. Not only are they exposed to new treatments, they see their doctors all the time. There's a whole team monitoring how they're doing. Judy Hall loves seeing her doctors every week, and being able to participate in a trial close to her family meant lots of support from her grandkids.
Everything that I thought might was wrong with me, they would say, "You okay, Granny? Do you need this or do you need that?"
She'll know more about whether she needs major surgery soon. As for now, she's able to focus on her family and herself. I'm Sarah Fenton, St. Louis Public Radio.
Well, see again. The people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii. And she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
Women from around the world have started going to a clinic in Ukraine hoping to get pregnant. The clinic is doing something that no one else in the world will do for them. Make babies using DNA from three different people. Earlier today on Morning Edition, NPR health correspondent Rob Stein took us inside the clinic to see how doctors create these children. Now, in an exclusive report, Rob introduces us to one of the world's first three-parent mothers and her son. Rob is the first journalist to interview one of these parents.
To meet this baby and his mom, I take the train from Kiev, 5 hours west, to a city near the Russian border.
In a few minutes, we will arrive at our final destination, city of Kharkiv.
I make my way to a big Soviet-era apartment building on the outskirts of town. Kids are running around a school playground next door. As I go inside and start walking up to the third floor, my interpreter reminds me that the baby is probably napping.
Right here, we need to be a little bit quiet.
The mother of one of only a handful of three-parent babies in the world cracks open the door to her tiny apartment.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Rob Stein from NPR.
My name is Tamara.
Her name isn't really Tamara. She's using that to protect her privacy and her son's. She knows how unusual and controversial her baby might be to some people.
Давайте вы разбиваетесь. Take your shoes off.
Take my shoes off, okay.
Because little children.
The shoes are lined up neatly on a rack in the entranceway next to a baby stroller. We tiptoe past the son's room over to the kitchen table. It's just her and her son at home today. Her husband's at work. After we settle in, Tamara starts telling me her story. She's 31 and always wanted kids.
Six years ago, I met my husband, and in a 6 months, we started to our tries to bring a child, and that attempt failed.
She went through round after round of IVF for years. It was a grueling emotional roller coaster. Nothing worked.
I was quite sad, and some moment I even lost my hope, and at some moments you even think about I should drop all this thing, but then you find some forces in yourself and some emotions, because to have a child is a goal which you couldn't drop.
Then she heard about a clinic in Kiev, where doctors told her about something new.
They explained us the procedure, its stages, and they showed us pictures for how many genes the child would have from mother, father, and all this unique stuff. They explained us properly.
The doctors would fertilize one of her eggs with her husband's sperm, then use her husband's sperm to fertilize an egg from another woman paid to donate her eggs. Next, remove most of the DNA from the other woman's fertilized egg and replace it with Tamara and her husband's genes.
My first reaction was, wow, how science got so far. It's unbelievable that they can make such a stuff. It's wonderful and unbelievable.
The idea is that a tiny bit of DNA left over from the other woman might make the difference. It provides energy for the egg and embryo. But the resulting baby would have DNA from three different people: Tamara, her husband, and the woman who donated the egg. But that didn't bother Tamara or her husband.
I knew that tiny little bit of DNA is not responsible for such crucial stuff as your eyes color, your hair, your character, and all other important stuff. It's very tiny part of DNA which seemed not very important for child appearance and his character, his mentality.
And it worked. For the first time in her life, she was able to get pregnant, hear her baby's heart beating in her womb, and give birth to a baby.
It was a lot of smiles, a lot of tears of happiness. I can't describe it. It's how happiness feels.
She never told most people in her life about how her son came to be. He's now 15 months old.
I'm so excited. I have a child and he's so beautiful. He smiles to me. He's so cute. He's so smart. He looks like my mom.
But there are big worries about this. The biggest one is, it's safe. Her son seems perfectly healthy so far, but who knows what might show up months or years from now. The procedure is banned in the United States, so one New York doctor went to Mexico to make a baby this way. Britain has just started letting doctors try it, very carefully, one baby at a time, and only to see if this might be a safe way to prevent terrible genetic disorders. Tamara says she wasn't bothered about how new and untested the procedure is.
I had no doubts. We had no doubts. I wanted a child so hard that I didn't care about how much experimental the procedure would be.
But that's not all. The donor's DNA could be passed down to future generations by any girls born this way. So any problems could be passed down for generations too. And some worry making inheritable genetic modifications like this could open the door to designer babies. Tamara isn't worried about any of that either. She's just thrilled to finally have a baby.
In my point of view, if you can fix something, you should fix it.
Tamara paid about $8,000, a lot of money in Ukraine. The clinic's charging women from other countries about $15,000, which is about as much as IVF usually costs in the United States. The clinic says they've created 4 healthy babies this way, and 3 more women are pregnant, including a woman from Sweden. And they formed a company with the New York clinic to market the service to American women. As we wrap up the interview, in Tamara's apartment, her son wakes up from his nap.
Hello. You, cutie.
My microphone scares him.
I'm sorry, but we're shy for now at this age.
No, I totally understand.
She tries jingling her keys to cheer him up.
I'm sorry.
Just as we're leaving, I can't help but ask, does she ever think about the fact that her son's one of the first human beings in the world with DNA from 3 different people?
Yes, of
course, it's still important, but at the end, we are all children of Adam and Eve, so we are all connected.
She says she's not sure if she'll ever tell her son about how he came to be. She might, she's just not sure. Rob Stein, NPR News, Kharkiv, Ukraine.
That's why we have to think as black people. Stop singing and dancing and start thinking. Wow. Thinking and reading. I say reading is more important than watching TV. And not getting addicted to looking at those small iPhone screens. See, where you were getting accustomed to looking there in a narrow space as opposed to paying attention broadly to what is happening around you. See, and people are getting addicted. That's why some people got tragically are getting hit by automobiles because they won't even stop looking long enough to look and see which way the traffic is flowing.
Smartphone zombies are a curse of modern life. People who walk down the street, eyes glued to their screens, not looking where they're going. Well, now, the city of Xi'an in northern China, home to the famous Terracotta Army, has come up with a possible solution, a special pedestrian lane dedicated to those who can't look up from their mobile phones, as I heard from our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
This lane's about 80 centimetres wide, 100 metres long, and it's painted green, blue and red, and it has pictures of mobile phones along it. So people know that if they walk in this lane, they can be looking at their mobile phones. So it's almost like a slow pedestrian lane.
Is that a busy area?
It is a busy area. The road that this is along is next to a huge mall, and it's a drop-off point for a lot of cars, for people who want to go shopping. I've seen in newspapers that cars have been pulling in and they've not realised that this is actually a pavement, that this is a popular area for pedestrians. So this mall has been pushing to get a smartphone lane for the past month. It's been saying that this might actually encourage drivers to slow down.
And how have people reacted to the arrival of this route dedicated to phone users?
Well, local people seem to have taken it. They've really like it. There have been interviews with people on the street and they've said that they think it's a good idea. It makes them feel safe. But online, on social media, people seem to think it is a bit of a gimmick. They've been saying they find it a bit silly that that people who are constantly looking on their phones might as well be blind and they should be taking better care of themselves.
Isn't there a risk that smartphone users heading in opposite directions will bump into each other?
Oh, absolutely, yes. That's one of the comments that social media users have said online, that if people are constantly looking down. And in China, this is very, very common to see. It's one of the largest populations of smartphone users in the world. People spend 3 hours a day looking at their phones on average. That, yes, people who use these lanes might actually still risk bumping into each other.
And is this the first time they've tried this in China? And if it's successful, might it be expanded to other areas?
It might. This is one of the discussions that's been happening online. But it's not the first lane. There was one in 2014 in a southwestern city of Chongqing where they introduced a smartphone lane. But then it seemed to be more of a gimmick. This seems to actually be a very serious solution to traffic. And this is a problem in China where cars do sometimes not notice the distance or difference between the pavement and the road and are not paying attention to pedestrians.
Kerry Allen.
you used to call me on my cell phone.
Next to a story which may cheer teachers around the world. The French Parliament has voted to ban pupils in primary and high schools from using mobile phones. The government said the new law would improve concentration in class. Lucy Williamson reports from Paris.
The new law was a signal to French society, the government said, and would help stop classroom distraction, cyberbullying, and access to pornography. Speaking to lawmakers before the vote, the education minister, Jean-Michel Blanquer, said that being open to the technologies of the future didn't mean that France had to accept all their uses. It's a law for the 21st century, he said, and for addressing the digital revolution. Under the new rules, schoolchildren up to the age of 15 will have to keep their mobile phones out of sight when on school premises, and parents outside this primary school in Paris were broadly in favour.
I support this move. It should be normal not to use phones in schools. My daughter can keep hers in her bag and bring it out at the end of the day.
It's a good idea. It will stop them being distracted by their mobile phones. But I think children should still be allowed to use them during breaks, so they can keep in touch with their parents.
But critics say that teachers will not be able to enforce the ban, and opposition parties have described it as useless and a PR stunt. 90% of French schoolchildren over the age of 12 own a mobile phone, and many primary schools already ban pupils from using them.
Lucy Williamson in Paris.
Imagine a world without murder.
I lost my best friend.
I lost my aunt.
I lost my dad.
I lost my father.
I lost my wife.
Just 6 years ago, the homicide rate in this country had reached epidemic proportions. It seemed that only a miracle could stop the bloodshed. But instead of one miracle, we were given three. The precognitives. Within just 1 month under the pre-crime program, the murder rate in the District of Columbia was reduced 90%.
They were going to be waiting for me in the car.
He was going to rape me.
I was going to be stabbed.
Right here.
Within a year, pre-crime effectively stopped murder in our nation's capital.
In the 6 years we've been conducting our little experiment, there hasn't been a single murder.
And now pre-crime can work for you.
We want to make absolutely certain that every American can bank on the utter infallibility of this system. And to ensure that what keeps us safe will also keep us free.
Pre-crime, it works. On Tuesday, April 22nd, vote yes on the National Pre-Crime Initiative.
The promises of technology and crime fighting have played out in the movies for more than a decade. The Minority Report from 2002 stands out as prescient because data analytics were used to predict crimes and stop them before they happen. The promise and peril of technology-driven crime fighting is the subject of John Fassman's latest article for The Economist, Data Detectives. In it, he looks at how law enforcement is using these new tools. He's joined on the show today by Faiza Patel, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Both, welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
Thanks.
John, let me start with you. The Minority Report was loosely based on a novel by Philip K. Dick and directed by Steven Spielberg. And in it, there is a unit called pre-crime, which apprehends criminals based on pre-knowledge before they've committed a crime. How close is law enforcement to having units like this?
Well, the pre-crime, it was extremely difficult to avoid using the Minority Report analogy in my piece, but it isn't exactly right. There are predictive policing technologies or programs that departments, I think around 63 departments, use. And what these do is they use data about crimes that have been committed to try to predict crimes that will be committed. Their accuracy is still a subject of some debate. They appear to be pretty good at forecasting property crimes like burglary and car theft and robbery, less good at predicting things like murder, and it's still unclear if they work over the long term. But what they really do is they give police chiefs a way to answer the question they will get from every mayor, which is, what are you doing about crime? And the answer is, well, we've got this great new tech that's going to predict crime. It's going to solve everything. But whether it actually works is not terribly clear.
So most TV police shows have followed this similar pattern. but according to your research, it's an outdated pattern of crime being committed and then someone calls the police. I mean, that's what we've seen on television for generations now. What is outdated about this formula?
Well, that formula is not exclusively outdated, but these predictive policing programs let police be a lot more proactive. So I was lucky enough to spend a day with the LAPD's patrol unit. What happens is at the beginning of every shift, their program shows them boxes, 500 square foot boxes of 500 by 500 feet, of places where they are the places that are predicted of being at risk of crime on this particular day. So police are dispatched to that area. They are told that between responding to calls, we want you driving around that area. The idea is that they will sort of forestall crime by their presence, and that will avert both the victim of crime and will avert having to arrest someone. So police patrol deployment is increasingly determined by these algorithms.
Now, you actually titled one paragraph, "It's Not Cagney and Lacey," and you describe just how much searchable information people generate now. How's that information used to identify future criminals?
Well, that's one of the things that I think society has not yet really come to grips with. The fact is we just generate in our daily lives, as more of our lives become digital, we just generate more data than we ever have before. And it is really effortless for police to track and store that data. So if you think, 20 years ago, had I done something that caused me to be suspected of a crime and police wanted to know where I went and who I talked to, they would have had to assign a rotating crew of police officers to follow me, to stake me out, and they would have had to convince a judge to give them a pen register for my telephone to let them track who I called and when. Now they can do both of those things passively through automatic license plate readers, which track where I go, and by using sort of fake cell phone towers that can capture who I talk to and when. And so the real change is the amount of data that can be stored, the effortlessness with which police can store it, and the ease with which they can use that data to build a complete portrait of people's lives going back 6 months to a year. And so there really are no policies no national policies that say how long police can store this information, who can use it, to what purpose. So policy has yet to catch up with the massive increase in data we have started to throw off.
And speaking of data, what information can be gleaned about us based on the apps that we download? Because they reveal a lot about who we are.
I think we have to sort of come to grips with how much of our lives can be revealed, not just through the apps we download, but by the mere act of carrying our cell phone around in our pocket and using it the way we do. As we walk around with our cell phone on, it's broadcasting our location to cell phone towers, so it tracks where we go. As we make calls and text, it tracks who we talk to and when, so it tracks who our friends are. And to the extent that we surf the web and buy things on our phone, it tracks our reading habits, our shopping habits, our political preferences. So it really is an intimate portrait of our life that we carry everywhere and that can be tracked easily everywhere.
And before I bring Faiza Patel into the conversation, to your point about our phones tracking our every move. My husband discovered.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
My husband discovered, just tried to look at something through Google, found that Google has this thing that can show you where you've been during the day, this very colorful map tracing your route everywhere around town. He said he was going to disable it, but he loves showing it to people to horrify them.
Yeah.
That one more question for you, John. In terms of police and our phones, can the police listen in on our phone calls without a warrant?
They should not be able to do that without a warrant. And one thing that we need to do is make sure that on our cell phones, our encryption standards are up to the highest possible level they can be. Now, I had a very funny conversation with a veteran European intelligence analyst who said that, when he got into the business, if he saw encryption on someone's phone or computer, then he knew that they were up to no good because there was no reason to install it. Now, of course, the modern economy runs on encryption, and we need to make sure that our personal data is as well protected as possible.
And one more, and then I promise, Faiza, I'll bring you in because the next question I'm going to ask you is pertinent. Our modern world, Does the Fourth Amendment protect us? The right against unlawful search and seizure, does that protect us in this modern world that we're in?
That is a fantastic question, and I think it is the central question, the central Fourth Amendment question, certainly, that courts are going to be dealing with for the next generation. The fact is, privacy laws around the world were written for the, you know, postal mail, landline phone, personal filing cabinet era. And so we really haven't come to grips in any deep or systematic way with how to reconcile those privacy expectations with the reality of our digital lives. The Fourth Amendment has been found to protect certain things as the questions have come up before the court. But I can't stress this enough. As citizens, we should not wait for the courts to protect us. We need to be pressing the police to be open and transparent about what they're using, to what purposes, how long they're storing data, and what tech they want to buy. So while we should expect the courts, we should hope that the courts take a sort of strong, they strongly protect the Fourth Amendment and update it. It's really up to us as first responders and as citizens whose data is at risk. It's up to us to press the police for transparency and vigilance.
Faiza Patel is the co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, and she has been nodding on your last point, John, vigorously. Faiza, jump into the conversation. Why were you nodding, I'm assuming, in agreement with John?
Sure, absolutely.
Point.
I mean, I think, you know, the points you brought up were really excellent. We've certainly seen the courts struggling with how to apply privacy protections in the digital age. We've had two big Supreme Court cases come out, which have come out really positively and privacy protective. And there's a third one that's expected to come down any day, which is the Carpenter case, which will look at, you know, what process is needed in order to get your cell site location data, what we were just talking about, because your cell phone is, in fact, simply a location tracking device. So that's a very important case, which we're looking to come out probably next week or the week after as the court winds up its term. But to the broader point, I think that it's really important for municipalities and municipal governments like the New York City Council, for example, to actually, you know, exercise their oversight functions over police departments. And what we've seen happening in a few jurisdictions, particularly out west, is that city councils have passed bills that require police departments to be transparent about what surveillance technology they're using, which would include, you know, predictive algorithms, to tell the council about, you know, what is the process required? Like, what do you need to use a stingray? Like, what level of suspicion is required before you start using an X-ray van? And finally, what are your protections? So one of the things in normal Fourth Amendment law, we're very focused on the front-end process. Do you need a warrant? Do you need a subpoena? Or do you need nothing, right? When you're talking about digital communications, it's equally important to have a lot very strong back-end protections. What do you do with the data? How is it secured? Mm. Who has access to it? Who do you share it with? When do you share it with ICE? When do you share it with the FBI? These are all critical questions which should be answered in local legislation that governs police departments. And in New York City, for example, the POST Act, which was introduced in the last city council session, would have done just that. It would have required transparency and accountability about surveillance technologies. And it would have also been really important to think about one issue which we haven't touched on, which is how do these technologies play into traditional policing biases, which tend to be really focused on communities of color.
Oh, so zero in on that. What do you mean?
So one of the things that we just talked about is basically police identifying locations where they're going to go and police. And that's called predictive policing. It's basically a souped-up version of CompStat, right? Which the NYPD has used for decades. And the idea there is that you bring all kinds of data into this algorithm, which will then tell you where crime is likely to be committed. So we're not talking about who is likely to commit crime, but we're talking about the location of crime. And the kinds of data that go into this are, we don't know, first of all, because most of these algorithms are black boxes. But based on what we do know, a lot of the data that goes into these algorithms is likely to be racially biased. So, for example, arrest records, right? Things like that, which will then reinforce the racial bias that you have that started out, right? So if you have police going back to the same places again and again, they're going to arrest more people because they just happen to be there. So your next round of arrest records are going to show that area as being a high crime area. Then you're going to send more cops back over there. So this is a kind of self-perpetuating cycle that we really worry about.
Is that what the way you're describing it reminds me, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that what they're doing in Chicago?
Well, they're doing that a bunch of different things in Chicago. Okay. In Chicago, they also had what's called a heat list where they are...
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Explain it since I brought it up.
Okay. So basically there they were trying to identify individuals who they thought were likely to commit crimes. And then they were sort of going to those individuals and saying, hey, we've got eyes on you, so you better be careful. And I think it was a little bit more than that. I'm probably oversimplifying
We did an interview with someone about that, and that's almost exactly what it is.
And my understanding is that the studies that have been done on the Chicago program have not demonstrated any effectiveness. And I think this was a point that was brought up earlier as well, which is that, you know, you have all these companies out there. They're selling all these fancy tech toys. And they're like, oh, this is really going to solve all your problems with policing. And I think we need to be very skeptical when we look at these claims. And I think particularly oversight bodies such as city councils should insist that police departments actually demonstrate that technologies that they're deploying are effective in what they're trying to do.
And one of the things, John, that Faiza brought up before we went to a break was sort of transparency in police departments and these predictive algorithms. And I keep coming back to this, maybe listeners remember me bringing this up at least a couple of times about a conversation I had with the president of the Knight Foundation, who made this point of saying even algorithms have parents. So if police departments are relying on predictive algorithms, who's writing the algorithms?
I think that is an essential point, and I'm very, very glad Faiza brought it up. All an algorithm is a set of steps designed to reach a conclusion. And if we feed the algorithms data infected with bias, we're going to get biased results. And this is not a sort of academic concern. We have found that in algorithms used, this is a court case in Wisconsin, that algorithms used in sentencing are not transparent. People can be sentenced for longer for the same crime than someone else because of a decision an algorithm has made. We have found ProPublica did a terrific investigation in Broward County that found that these algorithms tended to sentence African American defendants to longer periods than white defendants because they were perceived to be at higher risk. And so if in your predictive algorithm you use, for instance, arrest data, that will almost certainly produce a biased algorithm because arrest rates are higher in non-white communities because those communities tend to be over-policed, so you tend to have greater contact between residents and police than in white communities. So we need to be very careful about what information the algorithms used. And for that reason, again, I will come back to the question of transparency. It's not enough to say these algorithms are trade secrets and we can't reveal what's in them. They affect people's lives, and people who are being targeted by these algorithms have a right to know what's in them.
I'm going to throw this question out to both of you, but Faiza, you might be able to more aptly answer this question from a listener. And a listener wonders how the militarization of police departments play into the concerns we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the big predictive policing programs was actually developed in Iraq. So a lot of times what you will see is that, you know, technologies that are developed in war zones come home. I mean, that's a very typical thing. And I'm not an anti-technology person. I mean, certainly the police should be able to use technologies that help them carry out their public safety mission. On the other hand, we, the public, need to know what those technologies are, and we need to know what safeguards are in place to prevent abuse of those technologies. So I think militarization is definitely caught up in this. The other piece that's really caught up in this is federal funding, right? You have federal counterterrorism dollars, which flow to police departments. A lot of times they are allocated to purchasing these kinds of technologies. I mean, that's what happened with the NYPD, for example, when they developed their domain awareness system. It was funded primarily from federal funds. So these kinds of financial incentives also play into what's happening in police departments.
And John, in terms of your reporting, do you have any insight into that observation from the caller, the listener?
Well, I think militarization really, it brings up the question of mindset, that as Faiza said, a lot of these predictive algorithms got their start in war and are used to sort of predict the movements of an enemy. And I think that we really need to think about how police can improve their relationships with the communities that they serve, particularly communities of color. The LAPD got a new chief yesterday, I think, and he explicitly said that one of his main goals is improving relations between the LAPD and the communities they serve. That's hard to do when you have this military mindset that sees the people you're trying to protect as an enemy.
According to police, Deadman, with two teenage girls as his passengers, drove to a local McDonald's meeting up with the rest of the group. There, according to witnesses interviewed by police, he said, "I ran that nigger over."
And now to a story that we have been following for you really since yesterday, as we started to get notice that there had been a fatal accident in Vernon Parish involving a young man who had just turned 31 years old, that being his 31st birthday. State police are continuing to investigate that accident, which took the life of 31-year-old Sherelle Lewis, and it also happened to be his birthday.
State police say Lewis was picking up debris from the road when he was hit by a truck driven by 18-year-old Matthew Martin of Hindston. News Channel 5's Liddy Magiana spoke with some family and friends of Lewis and tells us why social media posts are only adding to their grief.
On Wednesday afternoon, loved ones of Sherelle Lewis Jr. gathered here at Sonny's Barbershop where he worked to honor a life that was taken too soon. He had just turned 31 on Tuesday when he was killed. He's remembered for his charismatic personality and positivity and the way he cared for everyone. State police say Lewis was hit by a Chevy truck late Tuesday afternoon as he picked something up from the road on Highway 171 southbound. Family says he was retrieving an item that had fallen out of the vehicle in front of him.
When I found out, I was devastated that my best friend that I grew up with was gone. That I'm never going to have conversations with or joke about anymore. I was just devastated.
Shatoya Ayers, Lewis's younger sister, called him her little big brother. As her only sibling, Ayers says as they grew up, they never grew apart.
It's so many stories me and my brother have when we were growing up. And there's countless of times of me just riding down in the car with him. We just have a deep conversation and just joking about him. What big plans we're going to have in life. And he was an incredible uncle to my kids. He would do anything for my kids. If I tell him this was going on with my kids, I'll be there. I'll be there. Because that was his partners in crime.
Fellow barber Dominic Hackett says Lewis also touched the community through his barber shop, often doing haircuts for charity, giving kids snacks for free, and attending the sports games of local youth.
A lot of kids come in here. They love him so much. They'll come in here, and it's one kid. He had a soda waiting for him every time. Every time he had an appointment, I come here, he got a soda waiting for him.
Hackett and others will remember Lewis as Big Bro and the life of the party.
One of the best dresses around, huh?
Along with the smile he always wore.
Even in the darkest moments, he still found reasons to smile. We're going to continue to lift up Sherelle's spirit. You know, as long as we're around, he's going to be around.
But as Lewis is laid to rest, family and loved ones are also reeling over social media posts allegedly made by another person after Lewis was killed. State police say they're aware and investigating, while Vernon Parish Sheriff Sam Kraft said in a statement that the posts were morally wrong and unacceptable with no place in society. Meanwhile, loved ones will continue to honor the memory of the man they called Rel.
No matter what, that's still our brother. That's going to always be our brother.
In Vernon Parish, Lydia Magallanes for News Channel 5, your local station.
And regarding the social media posts, Lewis' mother and sister told KALB they want the investigation to take its course.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 9th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have comments, observations, questions, counter-racist suggestions, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get started. The Cows is listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. You'll see the PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we can get you a physical mailing address. Definitely make sure you double check for the address. I'm still displaced with the flood, just to make sure that you have the accurate, up-to-date address. Tremendous thanks. Huge just appreciation to all the folks who have invested, listeners who supported and kept the context of white supremacy on for nearly a decade. I hope the broadcast has been, continues to be worthy of your time, energy, and participation for all the folks who call in as well. You can always support the program by sharing on social media. If you think any of the black people that you know and care about would benefit from any of the information that is shared on this platform, share. You can share it on any of your social media platforms or specific programs that you think might be of interest, benefit to any victims of white supremacy that are in your network. You can also support the Cows, my wish list at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. It is linked at my blog. If you do a search on Amazon, Gus T. Renegade. Again, sincere thanks to all the folks who have nabbed items from the wish list. Again, I hope the broadcast has been worthy of your investment and is helping folks get an accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what we can do to solve this problem, and what it means to be classified as white. Few things to share before we get started. Number one, the t-shirts. Please So excited. The new shirt, Please Treat Me Like I Am a White Person. The shirts have been ordered. So for all of the folks who contacted Trav and placed an order for t-shirts, they've been ordered. I think within the next few weeks or so, they should be back and he will be shipping them out pronto. Within, I would say, give it maybe 14 days and you should be getting your shirt in the mail. I'm looking forward to getting mine. For any of the folks, if you have the original, the Please Respect Me Like I Am a White Person, that in and of itself will be interesting. Is there a difference in how people perceive those shirts? Please Respect Me Like I Am a White Person. Please Treat Me Like I Am a White Person. The original, it was supposed to be Please Treat Me Like a White Person. It got changed. That's a long story. But we did have a prediction. One of our listeners in the VA area prediction was that whites will be less enthusiastic about Please Treat Me Like I Am a White Person. And the reasoning I'm summarizing, the reasoning was that racist man, racist woman, they are not confused about racism. They recognize the importance of words and that their system of terrorism is not about quote unquote respect. It is about mistreatment, and that whites will be perceptive enough that there is a difference between Please Respect and please treat that you're talking not about, you know, feelings or whatever, I guess whatever people associate with the term, the sound respect, but talking about I do not want to be mistreated. That was her theory, I think, but that whites would be less enthusiastic. And that has been my general experience. I've not had hostility in the 6 years, I think, that I've been wearing the shirt. Please respect me like a white person. I have not been met with hostility. Generally, it's been, oh, I like your shirt. And, you know, when they have either volunteered or I've asked, what do you like about the shirt or why do you say that? And it's, oh, yeah, that's, you know, it's being truthful. You know, that's the problem. Racism. It's, you know, they'll generally say something like that. They will never indict themselves, but they will say that, yes, racism is a problem and that white people are practicing racism and that it does make you. They remember Mark Studio told folks about that a while ago. I did have the white man with the ice cream cone. I have had a few, but that generally has not been the case. But we will see what the difference is with the new shirt. And Trav wanted to make sure that I explicitly stated there was a delay in the shirts being ordered, and that was at my request because I thought there would be stragglers, and there were, and they weren't just stragglers. They were stragglers who were emailing Gus about the shirts, and that was the, you know, number one rule about this whole process. But they were still contacting me late, and so I did not want it to be something where the order was already put in, and then 2-3 days or a week later, people were still emailing, so I wanted to give a slight grace period to try to catch as many folks or to try to give as many people an opportunity as we could to order a shirt if they wanted to do so. Next, couldn't have a Cows broadcast in 2018 without something related to yoga. So my compensatory investment request was fulfilled. Admitted racist Anna Brown Griswold paid for Gus's teacher training. I'm starting, I think it's 10 days. I looked at the syllabus, a component of completing the teacher training. Every student has to teach a class, and I think it might even be more than one class in order to graduate from yoga school teacher training. And I thought, wow, my whole goal with this was so that I could teach myself and not have to go to the yoga studio. I could do great classes for myself and I can share with other black people. I could be an instructor and teach some classes and share how great yoga has been for me. I say, hey, if I have to teach a class to graduate, as opposed to just having a room full of whites, I should see any of the Cows listeners that are in the Seattle area. Once I have the date, y'all should just come to the yoga class. And that way I can see if I can stuff as many non-white people into the class as possible to offset some of the racism, white supremacy. That would be, and I think it would be free. I think from what I've seen, at least at this studio, if they have teachers in training, which they do on a regular basis, if it's a teacher in training class, those are free generally. So I think it would even be a free class. So you wouldn't have to pay any money to racists. And it would be some great exercise. And you would be helping me complete my teacher training. So if you are in the Seattle area and connected to the shirts, I generally, this is, I think the class, if you are doing teacher training, you do not do heated yoga, but the studio does do heated yoga generally. So I'm accustomed to not having a shirt on. I think I would. In fact, I think I made the decision today. I am going to break my normal rule of not having a shirt on when I do yoga. I'm going to wear my Cows t-shirt for my yoga teacher training class. And I was thinking, it would be so nice, all of the Cows folks, if people that are in this area, if you are going to visit the Seattle area, you can come take a yoga class, wear your t-shirt for the class. Wowee, just to see what the response from the race soldiers present would be. But that would be grand. And it would be nice to have, as I said, to offset some of the white supremacy presence in the room. I will give you the date, but you should come to the class in August. I know it'll be sometime in August. That's towards the end of the course. Next, the segment on Puerto Rico where they were talking about, number one, the death toll. I talked about that last week. I neglected to play the report where they talked about, they originally said the death toll was some number like 65. Oh, whoops. Oh, it's close to 5,000. Sorry about that. Lots of non-white people in that area of the world. Race soldiers too, absolutely. But I think a substantial number of those deaths, individuals that would be classified as not white, disregard for non-white life worldwide all the time. In that segment that we heard from NPR, where they were talking about, because of the Hurricane Maria, you had a substantial number of non-white females in that area who are not straightening their hair and chemically mutilating their hair. They're not doing that anymore. In that segment, they said it was agua negra that was coming into the facility, the contaminated bad water. I did take Spanish, right? I got old enough to know. Agua negra is black water. Now, they do have the word dirty in Espanol. They could have said dirty water. That's not what they did. Black water. Words are important. When that is important, global system of white supremacy is not just English, where you have these phrases, black cat, and it was a black day, those types of the segment on the quote unquote opioid crisis. Same thing, where they said they were talking about the little white urchin and all the problems. I had something to say about that. I'm bringing that up to get the language point. They were talking about one of these little white urchins who might have been raped by another white race soldier child rapist. And they said, you heard one part of it, I think, when they said little white urchin was left in a meth house and his white skin was red. They never identified him as white, but that right there, major coding, skin was red. And then they said, you thought that was bad. It's going to take another dark turn. I would think, why isn't it taking a white turn? This is all about white people's problems piled up in Ohio. Isn't that right? Red in Nevada, formerly Ohio. This is all about whites. Why isn't it taking a white turn? The language, words are so critically important. And you can see that worldwide. You go to Puerto Rico and it's agua negra. And they have this in, it's throughout, it's rampant throughout the system. Really be mindful of that. So that's why I've been saying for years, almost a decade, watching the word fair. Continuing, that segment on the quote-unquote opioid crisis, great point by Ivy, that segment on the children specifically, man, can anybody, if we, particularly if we have any folks that are older, when I say older, over 50, if you can remember at any point during the cocaine crisis epidemic of the 80s, do you remember a segment where they talked about black children in that manner? Like, oh my goodness, this is so terrible. I can't believe it. Oh, it's so awful. What are we going to do? We've got to help these young children. Their parents are going through all of these trials and, oh, and people just breaking down every file. Oh, can't even talk. It's so sad. We've just got to help them. We've got to find, I cannot remember any type of compassion like ever being doled out, that level of compassion. I don't remember that level of compassion being doled out when black people are shot and killed under egregious circumstances. It's not that level of compassion for both the drug addict parents and the urchin offspring. I mean, why? It was 7 minutes. Most of the segments on NPR are not even that long. And to hear all of that and to go to the, wow, that, you are, everybody is supposed to empathize with whites. It doesn't matter what they have done. They can go shoot up a church. We're still supposed to empathize with them. Oh, are you hungry? Let's get you a sandwich. It doesn't matter the situation. It doesn't matter the context. We are supposed to empathize with whites. They are human beings, and it is the exact opposite with the negras. Doesn't matter the situation. Doesn't matter what's happened. You're some sort of criminal. You did something to bring this on yourself. You probably earned that. You were messing around in the first place. Consistent and worldwide, consistently. And it's not even that segment stands out. They have segments like that all the time, where it is so much compassion and concern. Really, I wish Dr. Welsing was here. I was thinking, wow, maybe this problem is substantial enough that whites are thinking this might even jeopardize the system of white supremacy if we have enough whites that are doped up and not passing on the management techniques of the plantation. This might jeopardize world white domination. I did have that thought, was curious, was wishing we could hear thoughts from Dr. Welsing. I will stop there. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If we could not use metaphors for this broadcast, super appreciated. Frequently, the system of white supremacy, the analogies, the cliches, and metaphors frequently, generally reinforce the system of white supremacy. Also, in addition, racists frequently use metaphors and analogies to practice deception. We're talking master deceivers. They will contrast and compare things and insist that these two entities are identical. Frequently, that's not the case at all. That is a master deceiver, a race soldier at work. Victims of white supremacy, including Gus T, we have been exposed to this behavior for a long time, and many of us, we are still learning. We've not come to conclusions on some subjects. We are void of logic in some areas, so we will substitute a metaphor of some sort, and frequently that just produces more confusion. If we could sometimes, what to do? I need a little more time to think. That is acceptable. I have to do that myself at times. If we could be explicit, direct about what it is that we want to say, that would be grand. I will prompt about the metaphors. And again, this is an exercise in being mindful about what we say. Frequently, when people talk about racism, white supremacy, we are not being precise with words. This is an exercise in being mindful about what we say, recognizing the importance of words. If we could take 5 minutes to share our commentary, that would be great. Make sure everybody gets an opportunity to speak at least once. If you have additional commentary, if you could wait until everyone has spoken once and then share, thank you kindly. Also, if you could use your mute button, if you know you're in a noisy environment, people are celebrating the Warriors win or whatever they're doing with their weekend, use your mute button, make your commentary, whatever it is you want to say, that's great. And then you can go ahead and mute your line. If you have additional thoughts or question or what have you, you can unmute when you are ready to speak again. But that just helps to minimize the disruptions and maintain the audio quality of the broadcast. Much obliged. With that, we will go ahead and get the first few folks who dialed in with commentary. If you have questions, comments you would like to share, feel free. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can you hear me?
Dreptomania, is that you?
Yes, it is. I'm glad I finally got to on the vote line. I'm so happy.
If you could speak up, though. Right, poorly. If you could speak up, just give us a little more volume, that would be great. Or you can move closer to your microphone, either or.
Can you hear me better now?
Slight improvement.
Can you hear me better?
Slight improvement. Okay. Just make sure you're projecting your voice. You should be good.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make a comment on the whole opioid issue. I just wanted to say that I definitely agree with you. There was no compassion, you know, when we were hit with the crack crisis in our communities. I have seen, been around and was, been victimized by that crack epidemic, and there was no compassion. No one spoke of us as look at the poor crackheads in the community. We were just looked upon as thieves, and look at them, they got crack babies, and I can even go back to the whole heroin epidemic when in Harlem and growing up seeing family members and different people with abscesses all over their body and holes all over, and they were all looked at as criminals, and there was absolutely no compassion. And so when I hear and I see, you know, it's like, oh, now all of a sudden you're supposed to have all this compassion for these people who are treated like they're such victims. I think what you were saying is that maybe the reason why they're trying to make it seem like it's so sad is because it's threatening their whole system. So, as far as the compassion, you know, they had none for us. You know, they were the only reason why we have to deal with these, the crack epidemic came into our communities and totally wiped out. I mean, it was like basically overnight. There were people, like our families displaced, people, you know, running around like the night of the living dead. It just totally displaced our communities and made people, you know, the crime rates went up. And there was no love, no compassion. We were all criminalized, so, put into prisons. So I don't see any reason why we should have this type of compassion for them. Why it should be like, you know, why it shouldn't be the same disdain that they have for us during the crack epidemic. And I definitely agree with you, Gus, when you were talking about how there is a difference between how they report these types of these so-called crises, I guess, you know, in our communities or whatever, in our communities. And that's all I have to say. I'll be in my line.
Appreciate that, Draftomania. Just wanted to make sure that I...
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Thomas in New York. Just give me one second. I just wanted to make sure I said, I did say this broadcast, no metaphors. Night of the Living Dead, that is a metaphor, simile specifically. And that one, very significant, because when I played the sound clip where she was talking, even the language of, you have had about, I think now, 3 decades of the vernacular crackhead to really just to brand black people, black children, black mothers, 3 decades of that. And even without any data, I keep thinking of Dorothy Roberts, because she talked about this. This was the first time I heard of it in her book, Killing the Black Body, where she said they did all of it for 3 decades, talking, oh my God, the scourge of crack babies. What are we going to do? These little Negro children, and oh, their mothers have been using crack, and they're going to be addicted to crack in the cradle. Oh my God, we're going to have to castrate them all. They did that for 3 decades. And then, oh, wait a minute, we didn't even do any data. We didn't even do any research on this. We might have just been making this up the whole time, practicing white supremacy. But just even that, the term crackhead, the anti-black racism, right, of that term use. You don't have a term like that for the white urchins that we heard in the clip. It was not, oh my God, these dog food addicts, oh my God, they're going to run over and kill us all. That wasn't it at all. And the same thing with Night of the Living Dead. That's a movie about zombies. They're not using that sort of language and those comparisons to talk about these racists and their quote unquote crisis with opioids. We shouldn't be using that sort of language to talk about black, and specifically Night of the Living Dead. That's a zombie movie. A zombie movie were the first two, one that came out in the 1960s in the middle of something significant happening. Can't think, but in the middle of the 1960s, the first one came out, the climax, a black person being shot in the head. They redid it in the 90s. Same thing. Climax, a black person who is not a zombie. Oh, yeah, he is. Never mind. But still, a black person who gets shot in the head at the end. So that's why we should really be mindful about metaphors, because frequently they reinforce directly, indirectly, consciously, subconsciously, system of white supremacy.
Well, Gus, I apologize for using the metaphor. And, you know, like you were saying, like, I definitely agree with you. There's bias when they're doing that reporting, and you can definitely see that. And it's not reported the same way. When we had it, it's a disease, and now when they're addicted, it's epidemic. So it's like totally, it's reported totally different. You know? So just wanted to agree with you.
No apologies needed. Still learning, all of us. Thomas in New York, thank you for your patience, sir.
Good evening, Scott. Greetings to all the callers. Right poorly as well. During the era where black people were strung out on crack cocaine, the compassionate words given to us was from Hillary Clinton. Like, she called out children super predators, because they were selling crack cocaine and people were using it. That was the compassion we got from them. So I have no compassion for these white people. Mm-hmm. Even during the era when black people were on heroin, I believe they called them dope fiends. They didn't call them heroin addicts. They always, demonize us. I'm glad we did the book on Katrina, Gus. To me, in my opinion, you did Pulitzer Prize work in the 10-year anniversary of the storm, especially when we hear about Puerto Rico. You see that their policies have not changed too much. Inaccurate counts of death, total disregard of non-white people. The only big difference was at least we got the visual in Puerto Rico of Trump throwing paper towels at the Puerto Ricans. We didn't get that from Bush, but at least he went there, at least. JFK, to me, and I'm going to word this carefully, he was the pure embodiment of a fine racism spewed by the racists today we call the Democratic Party. And they're still using his techniques to lure in black people to this day. Canada. I'm starting to think Canada might do it a little better than the United States. I found out recently that they pre-screen the fetuses of pregnant mothers and give them a percentage of or a rate of what potential diseases and things they might catch in the future. Saying if you go in there, you're 2-3 months pregnant, and they check your fetus and say, oh, he has a 1 in 10 chance of having a scraped knee when he's 2 years old or something. And it's causing mostly non-white people to have an increase in abortions based off of these numbers they're getting. So when I heard the clip where they're handling their heroin addicts and giving them cannabis packages, I just thought, man, they really know how to do it. I don't see this working. From my experience, heroin addicts will sell the cannabis to buy more heroin. Maybe that'll help with the withdrawal as a supplement, but I don't see that whole thing working. The last thing, played a few clips on the predictive policing and some of the technology. I'm just going to read a very short clip from this came out in The Economist magazine, this last issue that came out. It says, perfected in China, a threat in the West. The state could gather more information more easily than ever before. Do not underestimate the risk. They have a people in China called Uyghurs. That's the Chinese version of us. That's their niggers, the people that they watch and shoot down in the street and detain. They live in the Yangjiang region. The Yangjiang is a nightmarish extreme that new technology makes possible. A racist police state. Fearing insurrection and separatism, Chinese rulers have reinforced techniques of totalitarian control, including mass detention of Uyghurs for re-education with digital technology. In part of the province, streets have poles bristling with CCTV cameras every 100 to 200 meters. They record each passing driver's face, the car's nameplate, the car's license plate. Uyghurs' mobile phones must be government-issued spyware. The data associated with their ID card include not just their name, sex, and occupation, but it can contain relatives, details, fingerprints, and blood type, DNA information, detention record, and reliability status. That's their social credit. And that's the only part I'm going to read of this whole long article. But this is what they're going to be imposing on us here very soon, a version of this, not exactly. And I'll meet my mom. Thank you, Gus.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you want to share, or the first few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Let's see. We'll get the black female caller in New York first, but I did hear the other female caller also.
Okay. Thank you. I'll be brief. Greetings, guests. Greetings to all the callers and listeners. I didn't hear the clips, but listening to the commentary about the opioid situation and the children who are, I think maybe it's about the children who are the offspring of these opioid derelicts. I'm interested to see how this is going to affect the 9 areas of people activity, specifically education, because these children are going to be infused into these killing fields called schools, public school systems, within the next couple of years. And I want to see what sort of allowances are going to be made for them. They've already, the epidemic, quote-unquote epidemic, has already affected the area, the people activity area of law, in that they're allowed to get health care, special allowances through health care with Medicaid for treatment. I'm interested to see how all of this is going to affect the 9 areas of people activity. In addition to that, I just wanted to share something that happened to me a couple of days ago. And we always discuss on the couch the horrible practice of eating out. Well, I have a son who's completed his 3rd year of college. He is safe and unharmed from the white institution that has given him money to forward his education. And I'm grateful for that. And he's passed all of his classes. And he was able to come to South Carolina home for a brief stint before going back to New York. And he has a job over the summer there, and I'm grateful for that. But we went out celebrating, and we always do that. My server, white server, thought it would be good of her to say that after I had given her my credit card, and it was a debit card. There wasn't enough money on the debit card. So I gave her cash, and I said to her, I said, well, this is just as good. So I gave her the cash. And she said, oh, if it works for you, it works for me. Even if you come working and cleaning my house works for you, that's fine as well. And I kind of said, oh, did she just say that? And I looked at my son, and he looked at me. And I said, all right. Let me just take note of it. And I really just didn't want to make a scene, but I filed it away, and I said I will be returning to speak with the manager about her comment. And I did that this evening, so this is hot off of the presses. I went into the store, and I asked to speak with the manager. And the manager, white woman, racist suspect, Susan, I told her exactly what happened, and I explained to her that I was there and I had my meal and the card was did not go through. I gave her cash and I said, this is just as good. And she said to me, it is just as good. And if it works for you, if that works for you, coming to clean my house works for you, that's fine as well. Well, she said something like that. Anyway, I relayed that to the racist suspect, Susie. So the racist suspect, Susie, called the comment, the following words: weird, awkward, strange, and odd. She did not call it racist, of course, which is what it was. So after she made several faces and described the comment as all of those things, I looked at her and I said it was more than weird, strange, odd, and whatever other word she used. I said what it was inappropriate for her to say something like that to someone who looks like me, because I didn't come in here in a maid uniform. I came in here to eat. and her job was to serve me, and that was it. And do you know the saying that Dr. Welping always said, our great grandsister, self-respect, black self-respect is more powerful than a weapon or bomb or nuclear. So I don't want to mess it up, but I think everyone is familiar with what she says. I saw that on that woman's face when I said that to her, what my purpose was and what the server's purpose was. She was like, oh, no, this nigga did not. No, she did not say that. So she's like, uh-oh, you know, it's like, okay, we got one that might be a little bit more aware of the way things are going. But anyway, so she went through the, I'm sorry, blah, blah, blah. And then she looked at the, you know, the amount on the check, which is, I could care less. I could care if you spent 2 cents or $200. I could care less. So she looked at the amount, and then, you know, she said to me, I'm sorry. And then she stopped as if I was supposed to go, okay, thank you. Because, you know, that whole apology thing. So I said, no. And I looked at her, I said, is there a way I can follow up on this? And she said, oh, sure, absolutely. You can just leave your name and your information. Absolutely. So she walks over to the hostess and she gives, you know, gets a piece of paper. She takes my information. And I said, your name is Susie again, right? She said, oh, yes. And she gives me her last name. And she proceeds to give me a card with the general manager's, the owner of the restaurant's name on it. And that told me, oh, you're going to be receiving a call and email. All these other things. So we always talk about compensatory acts. We always talk about what can be done to ease the aggression against us. And I thought about that when I got home and I said, what do you want? I don't want a gift certificate. I don't want a free meal. I don't want anything. I really don't want anything. I just wanted to exercise my right as, you know, to show my self-respect. I really, that's all I wanted. And you know what? You know that we really have grown or evolved into this whole codification thing where you can refuse their trinkets. And, you know, none of that is, you know, that's not going to help. I just wanted to let them know that, you know, there's one nigga out here who's really not going to, you know, just sit here and be told that I'm there, you know, to clean somebody's house. That's just not what it is. But anyway, I just wanted to share that with Charles listeners. And the other thing that I've evolved, I have decided from now on that if I want to eat out, and I do like to eat out, and I'm guilty of that, that I'm only going to go to black-owned restaurants. I'm in the Columbia, South Carolina area, and I know of some wonderful black-owned restaurants, vegan black-owned restaurants here in Columbia where these sisters are doing the most. And that's all I'm going to patronize to lessen my own victimization. And that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for sharing. Dining code is super important. And those sort of incidents are so common, you know, I think for a lot of us, it just ruins, you know, your appetite and everything for wanting to eat. But black self-respect, the grandsister, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, black self-respect more powerful than a nuclear weapon. I heard that in the audio segment today when I was getting things together. But absolutely, I have experienced that myself, just exercising black self-respect, and you can see it. On white's face, like, wow, we're supposed to be able to abuse and mistreat them in any type of way, and they're not supposed to say anything or do anything about it. And wow, to have someone actually pointing out how they have been mistreated, wow. Black self-respect, outstanding, and refusing the trinkets as well. But dining code, super important, dining code. The caller at 1645. Thank you for waiting, ma'am, if you had commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I am a first-time caller. I have been listening to the cows for a while now, and I remember you guys saying that we should not just be observing from the sideline. I mean, not trying to use a metaphor, but just observing or be a spectator. And I started doing some self-reflection on myself, even after reading the ISIS paper by Dr. Press Welsing. And it made me think about how I viewed myself and how I genuinely look at white people, because I feel like as non-white black people, we have to be honest with ourselves, even to be able to exercise black self-respect. And one way I was trying to be honest with myself and be genuine is when I go to public places or even the gym, is this a good gym or is this a good establishment? How many people, how many white people come here, or how many of us black people go to this establishment? Or is there something wrong with this place because there's so many, is it so populated with black people? Or is there intentionally putting something in these establishments to make black people only want to come to these places and say, oh, this is degraded just particularly to bring in more black people? And I don't know if I'm probably the only one who thinks like that, but it made me think about, well, then if I feel that lowly about my own people, then that means I would have to feel that lowly about myself. So then I would intentionally try to exercise ways of black respect for myself. That way I can exercise that with of my own people and in my own family. And also I want to say that I've also been listening to, I think, the retired fireman, and I remember him saying about when white men would shake hands with black men and grab them by the elbow as a form of dominance. And I actually witnessed that. I actually witnessed a police officer doing that to a non-white black man. And at first, when I heard the retired fireman mention that, I was like, I've never seen that before. And shortly afterwards, I witnessed that, and I knew exactly what it was. And the black male, reacted in a way where he did not indulge back in, but he retracted back his arm and said, yeah, it's okay. He didn't go in any further and be like, what are you doing? But I saw the police officer walking away, and I also noticed that white men feel like they need to exercise their dominance, especially when black men is in the presence of black women. Even in my travels, when I went to England, I remember being on the train from Paris back to England because I was visiting family there, and a white man being intimidated or feeling like he needed to exercise his dominance over a black man because he was talking to me, and having to touch his face and letting it be known that he was his supervisor. And this black man was very well built, easily could have I know he definitely had a lot more physical strength than the white man did. And at the time I was a lot more confused, but even then I knew that this, well, he's doing this particularly because we're two black people and he needs to let it be known, even in this small and intimate space of just casual conversation, you need to exercise dominance. And that makes me even one motivated more to practice black self-respect for myself and for my non-white black people. Because in every sector, they always try to exercise dominance, even in where we would even be oblivious to it or not even see it. But then you think back and like, you know what? It is something that is very taught. It is embedded in their psyche. And I personally started to think that that is the mind of a sociopath and a mind of a people who has no intent of ever lifting or of any intent of stopping of their white supremacy, their supremacy over us. And that's just what I'm going to share. And I'm going to mute my line.
Thank you so much for sharing. First time caller. I'm glad you were able to dial in, share your views. Self-reflection is an essential component of the science of counter-racism, I think, just reflecting on our own experiences and things that have happened to us, things that we might have observed. And now that we have a better understanding of what it means to be classified as white, we might be able to grasp better what happened or what we observed last week, last year, 10 years ago. Essential component of white supremacy racism is dying. We talked about that consistently. I think retired firefighter might be with us this evening. In terms of white people dominating in handshakes, any sort of physical space, making sure that they show domination, even and sometimes especially over bigger, darker black people. I think Norm Stamper, a former race soldier, he talked about that in his book that was Cause to Go Get the Nigger Knocker, go get the biggest, darkest black person and get the nigger knocker, and we're going to show him what's what. Other folks we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Red in Nevada. Heard we had another caller as well, but Red in Nevada, we'll get you first.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to share. And hello to everyone. Right poorly as well, but definitely glad to hear more information about my favorite topic. So definitely thought that, of course, like everyone else has said, opioids being replaced with marijuana or edibles, that doesn't sound like a cure to me. It actually sounds more like a, you know, you're just really replacing one drug with another. And I remember I shared a article, I don't know, maybe several months back, where just talking about the different rehab centers and how they were replacing, how they were supposed to be curing like the opioid addiction and using like another substance, and then that just basically turning into the addicts being addicted to that other substance, and then they would then use that other substance. And I'm so sorry that I forgot the name of it, but they would then they could sell that substance to drug dealers and then still get their opioids. Real quick, just some information about Nevada, because it is like election time, of course. There was an article recently released, I think it was either yesterday or today, just talking about all the different, there's actually six in the article, six people who are running for different offices. Mainly, there's a couple assemblymen, justice of the peace, a Clark County administrator, which is basically more like a financial position, and the governor. They all have some type of criminal record or some type of criminal allegation. And what I am starting to try to pick up, along with my favorite subject, is just how white people are not being placed on the sex registry, even when they commit or even suspected of committing sex crimes, especially with children. There's this guy named, this white man named Aaron Manfredi, and he is running for Clark County administrator, and he was accused of having sex with a pregnant teenage inmate when he worked at a juvenile facility, and he was stripped of his law enforcement certificate. And also, they also reference on his website, because in the article, they of course make no mention of him having to register as a sex offender. He had said that, you know, it was a lie and it was fabricated, whatever, because of the month or what have you. But one of the things that I found interesting was on his website, one of his good attributes is he taught special emotionally challenged students. So just disgusting. These people are disgusting. The police surveillance clip, they used the term stingray, and I didn't know what that was, so I looked up stingray machines, and it's basically how law enforcement officials, they can go around, they can basically, that's a machine to where they can mimic a cell phone tower, to where they can cause, or they could send out a signal to cell phones in the area, and then that would trick the cell phones into transmitting the cellular location to their machine. And the ACLU, they on their website, they have a map, a U.S. map of states where they show the usage, how law enforcement officials, different levels of law enforcement use those machines, which I thought was interesting. Now, and then the last thing I'll comment on, my favorite topic, the current governor of Nevada, he actually wrote a letter to, and this article was from June 7th in the Las Vegas Review Journal. He wrote a letter to Congress seeking help with the opioid crisis. Of course, calling it an opioid crisis, not really what it is, not referencing what, the degeneracy of whites. But basically in the letter, he's saying, we need help. And one of the things I thought interesting, which was different from Ohio, in Ohio, there was state tax, so they can, enforce their racism upon black people who aren't suffering from this epidemic, quote unquote, financially. But in Nevada, there's no state tax. So he's asking for federal help. And he had said a couple of parts of the letter, he had said, everyday governors face the devastating impact of this disease on our communities. And then he also says governors need to increase financial and technical support to address this crisis and urge Congress to avoid burdensome requirements on state programs. So basically, they shouldn't have to go through all this, all these different, I don't want to use a metaphor, they shouldn't have to go through all these different things to help out white people. Those different steps are if you're trying to keep black people from getting the help that they need. Now, in the letter, which I actually went to the link, he discusses different different bills in the House, and there's about 9 of them, white urchins and their parents, to get over their degeneracy. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Red in Nevada, our resident researcher on the quote-unquote opioid epidemic, white degeneracy. Our caller, thank you for waiting. The caller, last 4 digits, 5771.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, this is Henry from Chicago. I wanted to talk about the clip where you played in regards to the white young boy who was being presented on a newsreel compassionately because of his addictive parents. I think they were either on meth or on opioids. But then also to when you were saying earlier about not seeing newsreels from the crack epidemic of the 80s and how young black children who were born to parents who were addicted to crack, how they weren't as cared for as this young boy. And I can vividly remember how these children were, they go to school and basically they were put into special ed or sometimes suspended and expelled without even, school administrators, without even, taking into consideration the situations that these children were in. It was just absolutely crazy. The way that they victimized these children, for the conditions that they were born into. And I believe it was Harriet Washington that I'm not sure, maybe mistaken, but she was talking about the crack babies and how that is just that's misinformation in regards to the way the children of the, crack generations acting because, they were quote unquote crack babies. And that's not, that's not biologically the case with these, children that are being born today. And I kind of figured that, because white people want to make it, black people can't act as some sort of inherent gene in our system. Where, we're just born that way, or, the people who in the crack era were just born that way. So I'm wondering what the children of the opioid epidemic will be labeled? Will they be labeled opioid babies, you know, so when they start shooting up schools? So I just want to know if that will be the case. And also, too, with the policing, the predictive crime analysis policing, last year, one of the newspapers here, the Chicago Sun-Times, had to basically went to court because the Chicago police was holding a list. It was called the Strategic Selective List. Basically, what this list was it was an accumulation of names from 2002 to 2016 of people who they predicted were going to be perpetrators of violence or victims of violence. So when the Sun-Times had to sue to get the release, the list released, they found out that 56% of these people on this list were black males. And they found out that out of the years that they were accumulating this list, only 3% of them were perpetrators of violence or victims of violence. So they were wondering why they were holding this list. But the main focus, like I said, was 56% of people on this list were black males. So, you know, generally they're targeting us, you know, basically trying to predict when they think we're going to, you know, do some crime because, you know, I always think that, you know, this is just basically a target for black, you know, black people to just basically watch them so they can have some sort of legal reasoning behind, you know, arresting us. So that's all I have on my line.
Appreciate that. That sounds like that old black male privilege again. Dr. Welsing's theory as well, where she talked about white genetic annihilation and the mandatory focus on black males' genetic material. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Other folks we've not heard from, hand up. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Aforementioned retired firefighter in Florida. Good to hear from you, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I'm a little bit more organized today, so watch out. Starting my countdown clock. The first thing, crack cocaine. My first decade on Dade County Fire Department was when the crack version of cocaine use came into being. As most of us know, cocaine was there before there, meaning in the area where we were allowed to stay at, but it was, of course, much more expensive. And crack cocaine became, you know, very popular because of its convenience. A lot of calls, a lot of emergency calls on the effects that comes out of having distribution as well as the sale of narcotics drugs in the area where we don't have any power to stop that from happening. You wake up one day and you are residing next to a crack house. So that presents a whole lot of problems along the way. It affects a lot of people. The situation that you brought up, you are correct. There was no sympathy for non-white black people at all. Matter of fact, white people actually went on the offensive to further denigrate black people and their inability to not respond in a way that they would like to with that particular epidemic that was in the areas where we were allowed to stay at. Matter of fact, it was so bad to whereas I have actually would drop off coworkers who were addicted. I would say to myself, I don't know where you're going. I don't even want to know. That's primarily what was taking place with some coworkers at the time. Number two, the death process. I'm basically with my mother is actually experiencing the process. I would advise non-white people, non-white black people, to have a code, primarily in the realm of a will, very important. So it would give an order to those loved ones who, it would give them more organization that would make the process smooth as possible. There's something that I observed that actually really kind of like got me a little angry from the idea of going on your computer and you will constantly see non-white black people using counter-racist understanding to argue with one another to the point of calling each other out of their names. And this activity needs to stop. Actually making money off of it through YouTube. And last but not least, Robert F. Kennedy, the publicity that lately has came out involving him. Basically, from my studies, he had a big problem with the aggressive, what was described as the aggressive efforts of non-white black people who were attempting to solve the problem of racism. He had a big problem with that. In the early to mid 60s, and he was able to, like some smarter white people, able to refine his activities to escalate himself into a position of power by joining in with the attempt to solve the poverty problem. And I actually think that he, although he was going to join in as far as speaking up on behalf of black people being quote unquote financially challenged, he actually was going to basically benefit white people who were financially challenged. I think that was actually what he was going on at the time he was killed. And that's all I have to say. And thanks everybody for listening.
Appreciate that, retired.
Oh, it's one more thing right quick. I got 55 seconds. One more thing right quick. If anybody wanted to know, the non-white black female who was released by the president, actually, Mr. Obama was in position to want to do that for the same non-white black female, but it was something that took place with the Department of Justice that prevented him from being able to do that. Just a tidbit for the listeners to understand. That information was sent to me and others via the computer about a couple of days ago. And thank you. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. Thank you, Gus.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Best wishes to you and your family as you all deal, care for your mother. And I know you've been talking before about the time you've been spending with her at the hospital, taking shifts and what have you. So definitely our thoughts. And
she's out now in hospice. She's at her house now.
Oh, okay.
She's been in that position now since Thursday.
Okay.
So yeah,
that's
where she's at now. But like I said, you know, be prepared for it, you know, everybody, you know, and primarily in the way of a will, it would very much help as far as to keep the loved ones from debating and arguing over the issue. Thank you.
Minimize conflict. Many things or tips, any tips to minimize conflict amongst non-white people that is always helpful and should be applied where possible. Also wanted to make sure that speaking of minimizing conflict, that's something consistently. I know Mr. Fuller's talked about it. I've talked about it. You do not learn counter-racism codification to debate with other black people. That's not what it's for at all. You exchange views with other black people, victims of racism. That's, again, the concept VGQ, victims guaranteed qualified, is supposed to stop all of that. It doesn't matter what another non-white person thinks about racism. If they agree with you, don't agree with you, that's irrelevant. Even if they don't think white supremacy exists at all, that's irrelevant. They can take their position. They're qualified to do so. They're a victim. I can take my own position. We don't have to agree on anything. And that should never cause an argument or dispute, because we don't have to agree. Even if they say white supremacy doesn't exist, fine. I just know this is someone who might not be helpful in solving this problem since they don't think it exists, but I do. So I'm going to just keep on my work. And I'm going to make sure that we don't have conflict, because that'll disrupt me from being able to do my work. No name calling. Talk about that on the program all the time. No name calling. Simple. 10 stops. Dr. Welsing would encourage that. Caller in the 712. Did you have commentary, ma'am? Line should be open.
Hi. Can I be heard okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. The main thing that I picked up from the articles, and all of them were great, but the one that really made, I just was sickened by it when they start talking about the crankheads and their crankhead babies and what happened, because I can remember when the crack came out. I mean, y'all probably already went over this, but when the crack was out, nothing, no sympathy. You're the worst person ever, you know. So that just really, really, I just didn't. That one made me upset about that, and because I have family members that was actually affected by that. I mean, we all might have family members, but with the crank, with the meth, they can have it. And that's all I wanted to say. I mute my line.
Yes, ma'am. Other folks, we have not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, we've not heard from you, should go ahead and share now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Jay in St. Louis?
Yes, sir.
Is it you that shared? I'm sorry for the interruption. Was it you that said your partner owned the yoga studio?
No.
Oh, okay. We have different person in the Missouri area. I'm not making that up. We do have somebody in the Missouri area where they have a... Anyway, I'm sorry for disrupting you, sir. Proceed.
No, I really want to take serious your proposal to really think about words. So forgive me for mistakes up front, but I'm going to try to take my time. I really thought about the segment that was from St. Louis, and they talked about public health and cancer. And I was actually fortunate enough to get a look at a study they did here. And the two top universities in this region and the state officials that are behind the way these institutions operate are fully aware of how segregated this region is. I mean, the difference, they have it down to the dollar, to the education level. They have it all laid out on the political science disciplines around here. They even quantified it almost 20 years in life, being born in a county called Clayton here in North St. Louis, and the what they call Old North St. Louis, which is where pretty much 99.9% of the black people in this area come from. So they know that we are exposed to things that cause cancer. And to the extent that I think research can be made available to us, it may be positive, but as long as this system exists, it's going to be manipulated. Let's see, the security, they talked about the security state and the police And here, I think this whole predictive policing thing, we also have in the St. Louis region one of the top criminology schools, and they just pump out police officers and people who get paid off of studying crime and pretty much predictive policing all over again, using these old theories where, just like with crack, which and the idea of a crack baby, which is completely false. It's a gateway for determinism that, oh, these Negroes are sick to the core and we can just, you know, they have no fate. It's sealed. They must be this way. It locks us in that frame over and over again. And I think that's sickening. But I feel like they have it down to the science. She mentioned in that, just lastly, she mentioned in that St. Louis piece about cancer that African-Americans also die quicker once they catch the cancer. I was reading about this last year. This is the same with leukemia as well. Lesser aggressive forms are killing non-white people. And white people are able to live longer with more aggressive forms and fight easier because down on a microcellular level, we have been stressed from this environment they have us in. So thanks for letting me speak. Hope to call in again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for your commentary, Jay. Other folks we have missed completely, please let's not have stragglers today. No lollygagging. If you have commentary to share, go ahead, get your hand up. *61 if you would like to participate. Do not wait until we get to 5 minutes left in the broadcast to decide that you have something to share. Folks we've not heard from at all, proceed.
Can I share?
Yes, sir.
Hi. Yeah, I want to just make a comment on the talk about clinical research. I am the background investigator, but you can just call me Sharkbait. That's what I go by on the vote line. My wife just recently had a heart transplant at the right young age of, that's a metaphor, at the age of 43. This was told to us by the nurse, and she got her heart transplant through UCLA. There's only 150 people that I do this speech to every year, and you're one of the lucky ones to get this heart transplant. So if you don't take your meds or you don't do what you're supposed to do, pretty much we can call the police on you, and we can bring you back to the hospital and make you take your meds because that's like considering suicide. So that is when you talk about the clinical research stuff, especially dealing with victims, that's like something you need to think about. That's why I think our health is one of the most important things we have right now. So just be healthy so we don't have to get in those situations. That's all I want to share.
Wow. Thank you so much for that. If folks remember, we had Dr. Vanessa Grubbs on the program last week. She came to Seattle to talk about her book, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, about organ transplants. And we had her on the program after she came to Seattle, and I saw her in person. And we talked about all of the different ways that white supremacy impacts when Black people have to get some sort of organ transplant, and these race soldier physicians come in and talk to people and say those types of things to Black. Now, you don't take your medication. And she said that is not an isolated incident. That sort of thing is consistent in the way that they talk to Black patients who might be in need of an organ transplant because of the toxicity of white supremacy. I did want to say real quick, we had a listener near the East Coast, thousands of miles from my part of the world, where she was having a problem with a race soldier, and she was interested if anyone might be able to assist with getting a background check done on a suspected racist. Is that something that you might be able to assist with if I forwarded you her email so you can see the nature of her request? Or
yes, you can forward that email to me.
Yes, sir. I'll do that. Or I guess if you could drop me an email to make sure I have your email correct, untiljustice@gmail.com, that would be great. And then I can just forward her message to you.
I'll do that right now.
Awesome. Thank you so much, sir. Other folks we've not heard from.
Yeah,
yes, sir. Is that Mr. Steele?
Yes, it's Kent Steele.
Hope the wisdom teeth are healing quickly.
They're very painful, but you know, my face is back to a relatively normal appearance. So, you know, there is that, but still in plenty of pain. I attempted to use some silver remedies I'm going to stick to the doctor's recommendation with the Tylenol 3s. I'm gonna stick with that. But I wanted to say that the break where you had the nappy headed hose contrasted against the gospel singers. I just want to say that you were wrong for that, Mr. Renegade. And I remember in the St. Louis segment. The St. Louis segment, they mentioned that the city was, quote-unquote, self-segregated, and I wonder, you know, who is the self that they're discussing when they say self-segregated, and then how is that any different from the self that was segregating in the past during the segregation that was, that is, you know, commonly acknowledged as, you know, regular segregation. And I wanted to say that the kid in the NPR segment sounded like a future school shooter, just from the description of the child or the suspected race soldier at this point. And just the recording of his voice, just very menacing. And it just seemed like, you know, how to make a murderer. They were just showing you how to construct a violent white supremacist killer. And I think that all of the children that are the result of these heroin addict, these junkies, I think that they need to be investigated and they need to be watched very carefully. And going back to the segment about St. Louis, I think it's really telling when they go to such lengths to avoid saying that they are targeting black people. And they're going and seeing these terms like people of color and then black and brown communities. I think that we need to make a concerted effort to say that this is affecting black people and that that it's black people who are being killed by police and it's black people who are being affected by racism, and we shouldn't use the term hatred. I'm hearing the term hatred and fear and a whole number of different euphemisms being used instead of the term racism. And I think that we ought to, if there's anything that we insist upon and, you know, make awkward in public, I think we ought to just insist upon when these issues are being discussed, we use explicit terms like black people instead of people of color. And I'll go ahead and mute my line at this time. Thank you so much.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. Thank you for the kudos. But that was not from a gospel. That was from Spike Lee's soundtrack to School Days, one of his older films, unless he started a religion that I am not aware of. Do we have other folks I've not heard from at all? Any folks who got a hand up we have not heard from?
Can I be heard? Have you heard?
Oh, I see. Let's
go ahead, sir.
All right, on. The caller 1989. Did you have commentary?
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Gus. This is Jenna from Chattanooga. I have. I normally listen to you via the TuneIn app on Cal's radio. And I've heard my description a few times. Retired firefighter had just mentioned the kind of racist logic to talk about other black people. My question to you is that when we're using this logic, are we to disregard the racism that other black people are going through because you feel slighted on whatever you're going through, and the people that that connect with what you're going through are attaching themselves to you and want to hear what you're saying? I have a non-black spouse, and for some odd reason, I'm supposed to be negated from the racism that I face on a daily basis. And I wanted to know what your particular thought process was on that. And before you get into that, I just wanted to let the caller before me know that before you get too deep into those pharmaceuticals, that it's a thing called wild lettuce that you could take as a tea that is like a mild opioid, but it's not addictive, and it's natural. It's just a weed that we probably walk through day by day that we don't know that it's it has medical properties. But with that, I put myself on mute. Thank you.
Roz sent me wild lettuce tablets when I got my wisdom teeth removed about this time last summer. I didn't quite understand the question, sir. If you could repeat it, that would be helpful.
Once again, a retired firefighter had mentioned that counter-racist logic and people using that as a weapon to attack other non-white people. I stated that I have a non-black spouse,
mm-hmm.
and I have been receiving some type of attack for that. Not that I have misinformation or that I'm telling anybody anything that's going to harm them, but because of me having a non-black spouse, that is the reason for the attacks. And I'm wondering, what is your thought process with, I already have how I'm going to deal with that, but I listen to you quite often and I would love your perspective on what you would, how you would deal with that particular situation. Thank you. I put myself on mute.
Okay. So you have a non-black spouse and other.
I have a white spouse.
Oh, okay.
Let's get that clear.
Yeah, okay.
Let's get that clear. I have a white spouse.
Okay.
And me having a white spouse is supposed to negate the racism that I face on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. I would, well, number one, I would have a request. I'll get to your question specifically, but I have a request for everybody from henceforward. If we're talking about somebody that is classified as white, please do not use the term non-black or anything else. Like, let's get to that quick, because this is serious. We're talking about somebody classified as white. Let's get to that so we don't have any confusion about who we're talking about. Like, it's no need for that at all. Let's be direct. Now, as for your question, I'm laughing because it's difficult because you asked me, if I heard correctly, what would I do if I was dealing with your situation? What would I do? So I'm having to imagine myself being married to a white person, hence the laughter.
No, Gus, not what would you do, just what is your perspective?
What's my perspective? Okay.
Because I have children, and mm-hmm. then I have to deal with, like what retired firefighter stated, I have to deal with people who shun those particular children, because I have children by a white woman and a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
What is your perspective on how to deal with that when I'm, because I, like I said, I have my own way of doing this, but I listen to you quite often. So what is your perspective on how to deal with these particular people? Me, myself, I am I used to sell drugs back when I was younger, which puts me in a position to be in a physical mode. Meaning that if you disrespected me in a certain type of way, I would deal with you in a certain type of way. Now that I have come to the understanding that all of us have certain issues, I try to deal with it in a particular way. But sometimes when people talk to you in a certain manner, you deal with them in the manner that you are most used to. Does that make sense?
I believe I understand you. I would probably ignore because black people, non-white people worldwide squabble and have conflicts about nonsense. Sometimes it'll be things that are serious and, you know, things that it's justifiable to be upset. And a lot of times it's things that are just nonsense. In the context of white supremacy, there is no beef greater than what, or I won't, there's no conflict greater than racist man, racist woman, racist child. So I would ignore, regardless of what they had to say about that. I wouldn't have anything to say if people, you know, if that is a problem for them, they don't have to listen to what you have to say. They don't have to engage with you at all. And just say, hey, you know, I don't want to hear or hear his views or hear his perspectives or read what he's saying about anything and move forward. No problem. I tell people to do that all the time with me as well. So I would just ignore if that would not warrant tremendous frustration and a reason to respond or feel like I need to retaliate, especially if it's verbal. I would say anything. If a black person is doing something that is verbal, they're not putting their hands on you or doing something that's going to cause criminal indictment or major problems. If it's just name calling and verbal, mute button, ignore, and focused on the problem. Other folks we've not heard. Caller in Florida, thank you for yielding the floor, sir. Did you have a commentary?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. To speak on the segment about, I think it was the student, I'm trying to envision, like, how was that? Was it like an image of that? Of the, it said the back of his head or it showed a brain or something connected to that, don't be a menace? Like, how was that described, Gus?
It was a tweet. So the tweet, I can post it on. I think somebody might have put it on my Facebook page already, but I can repost. But it was a tweet. And so it had the image of Marlon Wayans from the Don't Be a Menace, you know, blah, blah, blah movie and his hair. And then right next to it was the picture of the young black child's head, but it was the back of their head. So you couldn't see their face, but you could just see the back of their head and their hair. And that was next to the picture of Marlon Wayans' face in the tweet. And then she had her racist, tacky commentary beneath that.
Okay. I understand. While definitely trying to, finding more creative ways to practice racism, more malicious ways to practice racism. There was a segment that I think it was The View. Michael Larry Dyson was on there. And this is, like, I wanted to refer to this because of the racism that was practiced. He was asked about, I guess, his book on racism. And he was talking about how racism, black people can't practice racism pretty much. And he was saying there's racism and there's bigotry. So Joy Behar asked him, and I think Mr. Fuller, he mentioned something similar to this. She said something about Kanye West, you know, says, so Kanye West mentioned about slavery being a choice. Is that racism or bigotry? So, like, I wanted to just share that segment, that portion of the segment, but he responded by saying it was an ignorant statement, but I guess that's VGQ, but that tactic where victims get on these national or media platforms and they are, I guess you can say, well, maybe not baited, or they are deceived and misled to make commentary on other black people. There's another term that's going around. Like, I know you mentioned terms like throwing shade. There's another term, it was on a commercial where it was two white parents. They were told by their white child that he's lit, L-I-T. And I've heard a lot of black people saying that they're lit, like, you know, a well-lit area, like it's used in a sense that way. And I guess that's some kind of slang. Like, that definitely could giving strength to racism, saying like light or illuminating or something like that. There was another segment that was talking about the DNA or the three parents having a child or something. I don't know. I guess that was like over in Russia, it sounded like. And the lady just didn't care about the medical deformities or the health conditions the child could pretty much possibly run into. She was just happy, I guess, just to have a baby. And I found that interesting. And that's the only thing I have to share right now. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Indeed. Appreciate that. I'm going to double check to make sure we didn't miss any callers before we get ready to conclude. We have a little less than 10 minutes. I just wanted to make sure I did share the segment that was talking about predictive policing and how the use of computer technology is going to impact racist policing moving forward. The person conducting the interview was Jonathan Capehart, black male, victim of white supremacy. Now, I did the rewind in that segment. Jonathan Capehart, in addition to doing his podcast that was on WNYC, which is New York Public Radio, he writes for The Washington Post. A lot of his articles are about racism, white supremacy. Frequently, I have a very different view than he does on white supremacy, racism, which is fine. VGQ to Mr. Capehart. However, I did not know that he was engaged in anti-sexual behavior, married to a white man. I did not know that at all. That I will keep in mind moving forward. I will be mindful about that, reading his commentary or hearing whatever he has to say about racism, white supremacy, because I've been very definitive for a decade that has a huge and detrimental impact on a non-white person's ability to think logically about the problem of white supremacy, racism. I think I've said consistently, to quote the great Pam Trojan Horse Publications, you cannot lie down with a white person and then get up and fight white supremacy. Indeed. Anybody we missed completely have commentary? Did we get everybody? We got everybody? We didn't miss anyone? Spectacular. Thank goodness. We have about 7 minutes left. Did any of the folks have additional comments they wanted to make sure they got in before we conclude?
Maybe heard?
Yes, heard.
We'll get Red in Nevada and then our black female caller in South Carolina, I reckon now.
I'll be quick. One other thing that I wanted to mention about the Ohio segment, because, you know, I've lived in Ohio for a lot of part of my life. But the thing about it is that with those smaller towns, it's essentially white on white crime, because black people there are mainly confined to, like with most other states, the major cities and the surrounding areas, Dayton, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Columbus, Akron, those areas. And so, like, even when I went outside of those areas, just traveling in between those areas, you as a black person would be noticed very quickly. So all these different meth houses, drug houses, or whatever, and that's something that I've noticed, that they don't really like to mention that they are doing it to themselves. I find it hard to believe that, you know, it's a black person selling drugs to a white person. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Sorry about that. You had some background noise.
What's true, yo? What happened outside, yo?
If you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Did prompt about that before. If you know you're having other conversations or people coming up talking to you, Click your mute button helps preserve the quality of the broadcast. Female caller in, I reckon, South Carolina now. If you had commentary, proceed.
Thank you, Jeff. To the caller, the gentleman, I forget where he was from, who mentioned that his wife had a heart transplant. My thoughts are with you, of course, for everything that you're going through and will come through. I have a my mother's friend's husband. You know, we're talking, my mom is 80 years old, so, you know, we're talking seniors. Many, many years ago, he was in New York City, and he had a kidney transplant. He was an alcoholic, and he burned his kidney out, right? So he had this kidney transplant, and they did the same thing to him. They gangsted him and told him that if he didn't do what he was supposed to do, that they were going to take that kidney back. You know, and I didn't believe it at first. I'm going to be always tell this story, but it wasn't until I heard that guest that you spoke about, Gus, that was on your show, and this man's story, that I believe her. She said that he started drinking again, and you know, because you have those transplants, they have to test you periodically. So they found out that he was drinking again, of course. The new kidney started corroding. Do you know they pretty much arrested him, flew him back to New York, and snatched that kidney back from him? They had an operation, and they took that kidney back from him. And he lived for many, many years after that, but with one kidney. But he didn't stop drinking, and eventually he died. But that's true. But it's interesting, because I want to know if that's something that's practiced much more with Black people who have transplants than it is with white people. But, yeah, that's what they do. They gangster you, and they'll take those organs right back. But, you know, now they just knock us on our head, upside our heads, and snatch our organs out of our bodies, you know, after they kill us. So maybe not so much anymore. But anyway, that's all I have to share. I'll mute my line.
Dr. Vanessa Grubbs, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers. That's the name of her book she was on. In fact, if you look in the archives, the first time is the recording of when she came here to Seattle and she did a presentation on her book. I was there. I asked the question, is the recording of that? And then a couple days after that, she came on the program. So you can go back and hear both. But she talks about this exactly in the book presentation she did here in Seattle, and when she was a guest on The Cows, Dr. Vanessa Grubbs, and she's a lovely Black female doctor, no less. Any other folks have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter.
Yes. Once again, on the early, era, when crack cocaine, became popular. The one thing that I noticed is from the standpoint, you know, a lot of people don't like needles anyway. So the whole idea with heroin, I'm not saying it was a rare occasion. It was somewhat popular, but the crack cocaine was an easier means to use it. And I would figure that a lot of the people who used it had the idea that they can control their usage, not knowing on how powerful even the first attempts would be with it. And as I mentioned before, from my perspective of a firefighter, you have a gambit of felony calls that will result into some sort of injury or death, or, you know, in the form of murder even. I would actually see a lot of coworkers. We would come to the calls where it actually would be a coworker who had some sort of problem that needed to be treated. As far as that concerned, it became, you know, it was a very negatively powerful activity that was going on. during that time. I remember in the movie Godfather, what was the concern of Don Corleone was on how if we're going to control the distribution of drugs, that on how it would also filter into white people. And that's what they are going through right now. And they actually are working towards solving that problem. That's there right in front of our faces. With the constructive propaganda that they're pushing that supports them and what they're doing. And I don't think it's a surprise to anybody that's on this line as far as they're concerned that they're going to denigrate the people that they deem as enemies, which is non-white people. And at the same time, they're going to basically say, oh, well, you know, we need to help these people, these people, and primarily these people are white people who basically are what the residue that was, excuse me, not able to go through the process on the manufacturing belt of white supremacy racism that kind of like fell off of that track into the issue of being addicted to drugs. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. That will bring us to a conclusion for the evening's broadcast. Appreciate the commentary from everyone over the evening. Feel free to drop an email if you have an additional thought or suggestion, comment that you wanted to share. I'll try and get the article posted so that people can see the image of the race soldier white woman who was posting about the black student in her class, the hair feature. If folks have any other suggestions, you can feel free to drop an email. Again, the shirts, counter-racist t-shirts, should be here within a week or so. A week to 2 weeks, we'll put that sort of timetable on it. And I'm sure Trav, as I said, he will be immediate when they arrive and getting things mailed out. So you can probably count down the days till we have our new shirts. That's it. Thanks to everyone for participating, listening into the program. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Certainly, sobriety would be best with all of the conversing that we've done this evening about the variety of narcotics and poisons that whites have made available and looking to make more of them available. Sobriety would be best. Let's take excellent care of our brain computers. That is a metaphor, but honoring Dr. Welsing. Let's take excellent care of our brain computers so that we can come up with new concepts, solutions to solve the problem, fulfill our cosmic assignment, as Dr. Welsing would say, replacing white supremacy with justice. In addition to remaining sober, if we're out and about enjoying the summer weather, let's make sure that we're sober and buckled up. If we're in a vehicle, driver, or passenger, let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Develop your dining code. Let's try to minimize, if not eliminate, allowing racists, whites, to put food on our plates in our mouth. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.